Hello.
Hello.
Morning. It's good I waited. Rob came on. Oops.
Morning.
Morning.
Hi, how are you?
I didn't charge my wireless headset. Hold on a second.
Chris, are you there too?
Yeah.
Maybe. Oh, Chris. It's nice to see you.
You
Here
can't see
back.
me.
Hear you.
I see a cat. I don't see Chris.
That's what I look like. I only put on my human suit when I leave the
Ah,
house.
nice.
So yeah, I'm sorry I was just a little late.
That's all right. We were just wrapping up.
Oh, you all done?
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was nice talking to you guys.
Yeah, I mean,
if you wanna just quickly list the comics you read, you could just say the title. So I'm like finished. I'm upstairs reading, and Stacy at 10:10 decides it's a good time to send the kids upstairs to get changed and stuff, which only means they're just gonna walk into my comic book room and just continue like keep asking me questions and talk and stuff. I'm like I literally like read 2 pages in like 15 minutes. I'm like, oh my God. So I just went downstairs and I finished reading with the three of them upstairs.
Got assaulted with questions.
Oh, yeah, they got a lot of questions.
What kind of questions?
Just anything from, oh, do you like my shirt? To, what is this? What does this
Ah.
do? Oh, is that so and so? Is that like he was looking at the comic books, and then I
Yeah.
pointed. I said that. I said, "Who's that?" He said, "Batman." I said, "Who's the other one?" He wasn't sure. I said, "Red Tornado," and then he's like, "Oh, I thought that was Captain Marvel."
Maybe it
And you're
was.
like, "No, stupid." I'm just,
He
I'm
has the
impressed.
buzzer, the electric shock therapy. Bzz.
I just like the fact he knows who some of these people are, like Captain Marvel, and he knows who Dr. Fate is and stuff like that. I didn't know any of those guys when I was 4 years old.
Which Captain Marvel is he referring to, though?
He, the
Shazam?
only Captain
Shazam?
Marvel he knows is the Shazam Captain Marvel.
Yeah. And how does he know that character?
A while back at the comic shop, they had, it was a line of like small figures, maybe 3 inches tall.
Oh, the Justice League
That,
Unlimited?
they weren't cartoony. They were like, they say, I don't know what they say on them. It's like DC Universe or something like
Oh,
that.
okay.
And they had a Black Adam, they had a three pack of Black Adam, Captain Marvel, and Mary Marvel. So I'm like, oh, how cool. So I bought those and I
Oh,
gave them out
I
to.
know which pack you're those are the ones I started to buy.
Yeah, they're
Almost have a
super.
I almost have a full collection of those, and then I
They're
realize I'm
very.
running out of room. Yeah, they're really nice because they don't
Yeah,
have
they're
an
very. They're
anime they don't have an animated look.
not at all. They're very true to the
Yeah.
comics. So, anyhow, the first one he picked out was Captain Marvel. So I told him who that was, and he so he knows Captain Marvel and he knows
Well,
Black
he's
Adam.
got the red, right? I mean,
Yeah,
he's
that was about it,
recognizing
though.
the colors.
Yeah, but he hasn't seen his toy in a while. He's been moving on to Transformers,
Oh,
so.
you're gonna have to switch him to say Shazam because of
Exactly.
legal rights.
Exactly. Oh, so how are you guys doing?
Doing good. How are you, Chris?
Pretty good. I was on sort of a vacation. I was off Monday. No, I worked Monday, was off Tuesday, I worked Wednesday, but then I've been off since then, so last
Oh,
four
wow.
days.
That's an odd grouping.
Yeah.
I would have taken Monday and Wednesday instead of Thursday and Friday.
Well, I didn't want to take the whole week off because I wanted to save the time for other occasions. And
Yeah.
the reason I took Thursday and Friday off was because my brother-in-law and nephew were coming into town Wednesday night,
Oh, nice.
and we had a 50th anniversary surprise party for my in-laws. on Friday night. So we were both visiting and helping to set up for that party.
Oh, nice.
So it was sort of a weird week, but in terms of the schedule, but it wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Rob? Did you take time off?
I've been on vacation all week long.
What?
Uh-huh. Yep, I was on vacation. We were very busy. It didn't feel like the first day of, like, relaxing for vacation until Wednesday. We were doing something every single day from Saturday, you know, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, yeah, and Tuesday. Just very busy. But it was fun. It was just nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
But how about you? How's your
You get to go back to the grind then.
Tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. It's gonna be much more relaxing.
These kids here seem to really wear you out, Rob.
That's because I'm so old. I'm not supposed to have kids at my age. I'm an old man. I was 41 years old when these kids were born, and twins. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. I'm tired all the time.
I get worn out with my nephew and niece.
See?
Mostly yeah, right. My nephew. My niece is at the age where she's past that now. But
yeah. How old is she?
My nephew wear me out. She's like in 7th grade.
Oh yeah, so she's a little older.
Yeah.
We're starting to find
8th grade maybe.
8th grade.
Oh, no, wow. What am I talking about? She's not that old.
How old would she say she is? More or less than 10?
less than 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she's got to be like 3rd grade or something.
Yeah,
or
3rd grade.
Yeah.
That's why I was like, I was thinking, I was like, you're almost a teenager in middle school.
Yeah.
Fuck. Ours are just finally gotten to the age where they can entertain themselves for more than a couple seconds in terms of like even playing with each other. Like before, yeah, they would just sit next to each other and independently play. But now they'll actually play together, which frees up me and Stacy sometimes to do some other things.
Yeah, that helps us at least kind of have built-in playmates.
Yeah.
You don't have to have the kid from next door come over or something.
Very, very well. It's crazy. I think that part of it is, I think that they'll find less competition as they grow older because it's a boy and a girl, rather than if it was two boys or two girls. I think there'd be a lot of that natural competition, but being one of each gender, they just basically look out for each other all the time, so it's nice.
Cool.
Yeah. Mike, I listened to your weekly reads with that, the Heroes Con one. I'm kind of behind, but that was a great episode. I really enjoyed listening to you talk about the con. Yeah. It's cool.
That was fun. I like doing those because it's like a diary for myself.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised how easy it is.
I know. You know, I was actually thinking that because you're finally at the point where you're like, you're like, Barb's going to be home soon. I got to get going on this.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mike does a really good job of just like, he's got nobody to bounce against. And he's just, there's no like long, just silences or something. You just start going and you run with it.
Yeah, I don't think I'd have a hard time if I was like today where I, am hooked up to the computer. I think well when I'm moving.
Yeah.
So while I record that episode, I pace around. Like I'm walking back and forth. It helps the stream, you know, stream ideas and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So why were you in such a bad mood the other day?
I was in sort of a bad mood. That was the lyrics to a song.
Oh, you had everyone worried.
Had a bad day. Don't talk to me. I don't even remember who it is. It's like, you can save me. I don't know who the band is.
I don't know that. I don't know it at all. But everyone was like, oh my God, my kid is really crabby. Must have been a really bad day.
Well, it was a bad day work-wise, but it wasn't a bad day. Like, I can take it.
Oh, that's good.
I didn't know what song it was, but I knew it was song lyrics, because
I do the dot, dot, dots.
I figured it was.
If you see the dot, dot, dots and not complete sentences, it's usually a lyric.
I thought you just didn't want to talk anymore about it because you're so pissed off.
I think it was the don't talk to me part, because you post sometimes if you have a rough time or a rough day or something, but you don't usually, if you don't want people to talk to you, you just don't post.
Yeah, why would I post if...
yeah.
I don't ask for, what do you call it?
You're not an attention getter like that.
Yeah, I'm not an attention getter.
Like, that's true. Guess what just happened?
I'll be coding away and I hear a song and I'm like, damn, those are some great lyrics. I'll post them.
But I know, Chris, I know exactly what you're talking about. We all have those Facebook friends that will just post something super vague that they're so totally either upset or like angry about, because the only thing that they want is for people to reply back asking them what's wrong.
Right.
Instead of just saying, I'm pissed off about such and such, they leave it super vague so they'll get a lot of attention.
Yeah. That's pretty common.
Yep.
If you see it during the day, it's mostly a lyric.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. I don't post much during the day. It's just like, I'll be coding. I'm like, hey, that's an awesome lyric.
Chris, where did you get those new comic books?
Ooh, those essentials for a dollar. Holy crap.
Yeah, that was at a yard sale.
You're kidding me.
Man, they must have really wanted to get rid of those. And they don't look like they're beat up either. They don't look like they've been trashed.
No, it was a street that had a bunch of different garage sales, and I found it on Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
They said there was comics, and I drove down the street. I didn't really feel like getting out and actually
walking around
and looking at each one, and so I was only going to check it if I spotted comics from the car.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as I was passing the last
one,
you
must have good eyes, man, like eagle eyes. Like you're like, hey, there's comics.
Yeah, no doubt.
Because sometimes those are like hiding in a box or something.
I can do pretty well at flea markets walking by. It's like I have that sixth sense that, oh, there they are. Like without any, but no, I don't think I could do a driving by like.
Well, I knew that also increased my chances of missing them if they were just tucked back somewhere, but I just didn't feel like doing that much of a search. I figured if I happened to see them from the car, then I'd get out if it looked worth it, whatever I saw. And it just so happened that they had four short boxes sitting on a pretty high table.
Mm-hmm.
That I was able to spot, so I did get out. And the comics were all, it really seemed like someone, whether it was a kid or an adult, I don't know, but someone was briefly into comics around maybe 4 years ago or so, because almost everything except for a few random issues that they must have just got here or there, almost everything was from around that time. It was all, three of them were Marvel and one of them was DC, roughly, and they were all around New 52 and Marvel Now, the first Marvel Now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all just from a snippet of time. And then they just happened to have a little stack of trades, and the trades were all a dollar. So yeah, I was surprised, but yeah, it's one of those things. It's just like someone was briefly into comics, probably their kid or something, and then he just totally lost interest and was like, get rid of them, you know?
Yeah.
And they're not people that really, they're just having a yard sale to get rid of stuff, you know? It's like not it wasn't in a neighborhood where people need, or, you know, they wouldn't be living there if they really needed money, you know?
Yeah.
So just the same way, like, you know, and then when he's probably, when he's 38, he's probably going to be like, I am like, man, I wish I didn't sell that stuff for that. You know, because, like, that's how I got, that's where all my G.I. Joes and Star Wars and, like, Masters of the Universe and all that stuff went.
I didn't sell them away.
I just sold them at yard sales, and I was super pumped about the money I got, you know. Were you doing comics like a buck a piece,
or were you doing them really cheap?
I have no idea. My memory's not that good. I have no idea. I just know I sold them.
The only time I've sold anything is if
I know it was cheap. Like, it was garage. They were garage sale prices. I wasn't like, oh, these are going to be valuable or whatever. I was thinking about you yesterday, Mike.
G.I. Joe number one and number two are pretty valuable.
I'm talking about action figures.
Oh, the toys.
Yeah, I didn't really have much licensed property. I didn't have any G.I. Joe or Star Wars comics. I liked both those properties, but I didn't think of them as comics. I just had pretty much Marvel superhero comics. And
yeah.
I remember trying to sell the comics I had and later on. And the guy, I was one of those people, and that the guy at the comic shop just laughed.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, this stuff is not worth anything. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you have to bulk sell it or just have a convention where somebody wants to go through your box and pick up a full run of Avengers or something.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty much out of the comic book loop at that point, you know, so I just was like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, I just got a box of comics from Paul Tessner.
Oh yeah, from the yep. the one he has a this garbage bag of comics or
yes. It was had to be 50, 60 comic books for 15
What was
bucks.
It? What was in that one? What did you get?
And you know what? He did a good job. I mean, not because, you know, it's pretty much sight unseen, you know. I gave him a few tips and stuff like that, and he put stuff together. But I've got to say, I think that over 3/4 of the comic books that he sent me, I don't have. There was a handful of continuity comics that
I definitely do not have.
Mm-hmm. Like a whole, can't even remember. I only glanced through them once.
Those must have been the ones that he said were junk.
Probably.
Those ones are they look like all the artists are trying to mimic. It was like Neil Adams was hiring
people
that had his style. Like, so everything looks very similar, and things are written kind of weird even back then. Like, just that those are weird stories. Like the hybrids, and you probably got Megalith or the, I think one of them's the Revengers.
Yeah.
Crazy Man. What did you get?
I can't remember what the name of the
Earth
book of
War.
The, is it Earth War? I can't remember. You know what? Later I'll grab them. They're upstairs. Yeah. But then a lot of like late 90s, probably even early 2000 DC, but like a little bit odder of the titles, like not just regular titles that I probably would have already had.
Yeah.
Although, you know, some of them are odd, like there was a Superboy in there and a Supergirl in there. I just don't happen to have those. What else was in there? There was a few other ones that I've never heard of, but then the one that was in there that I know we discussed that I didn't even know existed was that second series of Infinity Inc. that you guys were telling me about.
Oh, yeah.
With
that
Steel?
That came out of New 52.
Yeah, so the issue number one was in there. So I've never seen, you know, those, but I never even heard of them until you mentioned them,
yeah.
You know, a couple episodes back. So now I'll read the first issue. But yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, he packs those comic books great.
Yeah.
Because the box itself looked
like. What did
you
buy him for? Like the whole, or did you send him on his Goodwill or what?
Yeah. Pay for shipping? He's like, you remember when you guys were talking about the, at Target, like the four comics, bag. I said, yeah. He's like, well, I have a random offer for you. He's like, do you want like 50 or 60 comic books for $15?
Like,
sure. So that's what the price was. It was just $15 total.
Yeah. And
so
it sounds
it's not making anything at all.
Yeah. It sounds like you got a hodgepodge of things you didn't have.
Yeah. It was really good. It was really good. But like I said, I mean, he packs it so well. The box looked like somebody used it as like a football.
Yeah.
But then you open it up. I mean, the box literally almost came apart as I was opening it.
Yeah.
And comic books, were absolutely secure. Yeah. But you know
what I've learned about the post office is I've been burned so many times, and this is just my personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever ship anything in a manila folder or anything that's non-postal. Because it'll be run over with tires. The top will be ripped open. Sometimes the contents are gone. But I've never had that problem when I ship, like I ship to you, Rob.
Yep.
Like in those envelopes, and I can track it. I've never had those problems. So I pay extra, but it gets there. Like
right.
It sucks because it's like $7 almost. I know I'm guaranteed that it'll get there
exactly.
And not be run over and the content's missing.
Well, I mean, he did it media mail. And
yeah,
that's like,
they scare the hell out of me.
He did it so well. It was no issue at all.
Yeah. I used to order from, you've heard of the writer Paul Kupperberg, right?
Uh-huh.
He used to sell his collection. He was selling his collection. And he had some good stuff. I'm talking about like stuff that from the 60s and 70s, and he'd have a bunch posted every week. So I went on this tangent where every week I'd look at his store and I'd buy stuff. And then one time I had an empty manila folder because it was going media mail. And that was the one time that I had spent at least $150. And it sucks trying to get money from the post office, I'll tell you that. And I only recouped half of it. That's all they would give me, even though I lost over $100. I got like a $50 check or something like that.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah,
but that was fun. I might take them up on another box. It's for $15. It's just cool to, see what you get.
Yeah.
Who is that from?
Continuity stuff. If you don't want it, I have some gaps I need to fill. So
I'll take a look to see what I got.
Yeah.
And I'll if I have time, I'll grab it before end of the podcast. Otherwise, I'll just message you.
Yeah. Cool.
It's from Paul Tessner of Central Podcast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He does a lot for the community, like in terms of comics. If you're looking mm-hmm. for something, he'll try to find you something. And I mean,
he really doesn't
spend a lot of money on comics like mm-hmm. like I do, but he does stay ingrained in the comics world through friends good acquisitions. So
yeah, he's helped a lot of people out with a lot of variants too for Valiant, because even though he doesn't necessarily buy them, he's got a great relationship with his comic store.
Yeah.
So he'll make arrangements so they'll buy them, and then he'll pass them on to his friends. So yeah, very good. It's very good.
All right. Well, let's kick this bad boy off.
Yeah.
Unless you guys have any other random topics you want to talk about.
I don't think so.
Hey, did you order that controversial comic book, any of you? What is the Howard Chaykin book?
No, what is controversial about it?
Oh, I don't think it's controversial, personally.
No, I don't know anything about it. I've heard people talk, but I don't know.
Do you still have your previews?
Uh-huh.
Look for the Divided States of Hysteria.
What's the publisher?
Image.
Image.
Okay.
And if you go to the image section and look it up, it has the cover on there. Like, it was solicited with that. It didn't really go viral until a few articles came out about it. Hmm. But it's like, people aren't buying it. Like, he's not doing this to make money. Nobody's buying it. He's just trying to make a message. He's trying to say a message. And yeah, it's a violent cover. But, you know, we've seen worse.
It's just a violent one?
No, it's a hanging of a Pakistani man. And I think his genitalia is missing. Or...
Oh, my. On the cover?
Yeah, on the cover.
Oh wow.
But they recalled it. They stopped.
You're kidding.
Putting it out, yeah.
Like, so is that one that's already been published?
No, only issue one has come out so far.
Uh-huh. But that particular issue, I mean, is that cover you're talking about, is that already been out and published?
No.
Or not? Okay, gotcha.
No, it's in the latest previews.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. Okay. Very interesting.
I bought it just because it's Howard Chaykin. The thing that's weird about it, though, is he's always been that way. Like, if you read American Flag or Black Kiss or any of that stuff, he's always very vocal about the current state of the world.
Yeah.
And he has messages in there, so if you don't like that stuff, you don't read it.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. I like Howard Chaykin. I'm a fan of his. I think that his messages are there. Now, whether people, like, he should have put that on the cover, probably not. Like, it would have never been an issue. But,
right.
Like, I don't know if it was... I'll tell you one thing. By letting it out of the hat, it probably sold a lot of issue number ones. Because people love controversy.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Oh, they thrive on it.
Reminds me of that.
Speculators, especially, they'll go to the shop and buy all 10 copies. Do you know what I mean? And that's what happens, is that stuff causes them to buy the 10 copies, and then there's a supply and demand issue.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And then it inflates it. Yeah.
Do you hear anything in the background?
Yeah, but that's okay.
Is that coming from Chris's house?
It could be.
I don't have any kids that I know of.
Exactly, that's why I'm concerned.
No, if it fits us, usually hear a squeaky toy just go around uncontrollably.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Or you hear Barb yelling at me.
Ellie was very upset about something. I don't know what's going on. They just came back from the store.
Did you pre-order that book, by the way?
I did not.
United States of Hysteria?
Mm. Mm-mm.
No, I don't pre-order anything anymore.
Oh, you're done. It's all old.
Really?
Well,
you're done, huh?
Oh, yeah. I haven't placed a DCBS order in a while. I still read some new... Like, the last couple of weeks, I've been reading some new stuff, but from the library.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not worth it to me, like... If I read it from the library, then I can react more favorably to it, because I'm not affected by feeling like I wasted my money because it only takes me 5 minutes to read.
Yeah.
I mean, I swear to God, it's gotten so bad. It really affects, like, new comics. When I rate them, they start off at a disadvantage because it already affects my enjoyment by how quick they are. You know.
Yeah, that's too bad.
And
there's a big difference. Like, if I go
significant
80s and prior, I spend 20 to 30 minutes reading it and looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
If it's a book now, it's 5 to 10 minutes depending on what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the Valiant books, they have a lot of content. Like, it's not all publishers, but like a DC book, it's a quick read, man. And they're 20 pages.
Yeah,
and it's not.
That's the other thing that
it's not 22 pages like it used to be. Right. But to be fair, in the 70s, DC did play around with the 17-page format.
Yeah, one of my books is only 17 pages, and it's a damn good thing. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been done in time.
Yeah, I was surprised. I went into this fad with page count recently, where I'm just counting pages of older books, you know? And I was like, wow, in the 70s, 17 pages. I'm like, wow. But it read like there were 30 pages because they were pretty dense. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't even. That's the thing. Unless you're paying attention, you still feel like it's a long story because you're so used to the modern day ones.
Yeah. And everything I read for this episode was such. They had large page. Numbering, like legacy numbering, and I went into this thing where I just said, god dang, I miss it. Mm-hmm. I was rereading Hush, and I was like on 608, you know, Batman 608, and that meant something back then. It doesn't
mean... Oh, you're talking
about
the number.
The number, it meant something. That's 600 issues. And just looking at your database, it's impressive just to pull up Batman and see all those freaking issues. And then you look at a volume today, and it's like 52, and you're like, oh, you know.
52, and that's a long period of time
nowadays.
That's
a long run, yeah. And then, like,
DC is comparatively doing long runs compared to Marvel and Valiant and, you know, some of the other publishers.
And I'm a mood reader, and I went into Iron Man, and I read three different volumes of Iron Man. And it was just really weird because – They're all different volumes, and they're all, some of them are titled differently. Some are actually Invincible Iron Man, some are Iron Man, Infamous Iron Man, International Iron Man.
So, what's your take? And Chris, you as well, if you guys care one way or the other about Marvel going back to those large numbers coming this fall.
It's just a gimmick to me, just like Action Comics and Detective Comics. Once you end the volume and start another one, it's over. You know, I don't think it means anything to return to the numbering. And I think it's silly to just include everything, like conclude the old volumes, you know?
Like Venom.
As if they're part of the series.
Yeah, it's just silly.
Like Venom,
yeah, it's just
a
gimmick.
Venom was based on all miniseries. He had one ongoing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't possibly say that Venom has a legacy of 150 issues.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
If it's like Action Comics to me, but like I can't compare Action Comics because they've only broken away once.
It's definitely not as bad, but I don't think it's a new volume. Like I think of the current as volume 3. Even though they returned the numbering, but
and in archiving, you have to archive it as such. Like
I
would never archive it with volume one. That's insane.
I'm totally with you guys, 100%. And I would prefer. Now I understand in terms of somebody made a great point with just story continuity. It wouldn't make any sense. But I actually appreciate. More like when Flash, Barry Allen started, his first issue was 105 because the previous issue was 104, right? And then I think even the second volume of Flash, it did the same thing, didn't it? It went away and then it came back?
Yeah.
Toward the end, it came back briefly because they
screwed up
the whole Barry Allen thing.
Yeah, so it ended at 230. It came back about a year and a half later, a little more than that, at 231. So that at least is continuing the same volume.
Right.
That's but different. if you're breaking it up and then adding a bunch of other stuff and then saying now we're at issue one, you know, whatever, then I agree. It's not the same volume. They can call it whatever they want. Now, at least on the DC side, who knows what will happen in the future, but I wouldn't be surprised if they left the numbering for Detective and Action after it hits its milestones and keeps going with, you know, that numbering. But I mean, with Marvel, I don't think there's any doubt that, it, you know, some point soon down the road, whether it's a year from now or a year from September or even 2 years from September, you know, they'll relaunch as number ones again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's you know, it really doesn't, like you said, Chris, I don't feel like it really means anything. It's just, you know.
Invincible Iron Man is an interesting one. Okay, so this is the Matt Fraction Invincible Iron Man. So it started, this is volume one of Invincible Iron Man, because the other one was just called Iron Man, even though it had Invincible in the title.
Right.
Matt Fraction's jumped, it like went to issue, I don't know, 50-some, and then jumped to like 500, like bang, in that volume.
Oh,
like
right,
if you pull it up in your database, that's what it shows up as.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But that's how I would archive it, too, because it's really,
of course.
It continues the same story, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just weird.
Yeah, Detective and Action aren't as bad, and I know that they were hesitant to renumber those with the new 52. At first they wanted to keep those two, and then they decided no, we want to go all in across the board on this initiative, and then I think they regretted that decision, and that's why they returned them with Rebirth. So it's not as bad, and I think it won't feel as exciting when they reach 1,000 issues as it would have if they hadn't done that, but I think they still can celebrate something a bit there, and mm-hmm. I think that they can kind of, I agree with you, Rob, that there's a better chance that they'll continue to 1001, especially I think they've seen that it really doesn't affect the number, it doesn't affect sales that much as they might have thought, or as Marvel might think.
Yeah.
I actually think that the heads of DC regretted it, just like you said, Chris.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I
think they said this was our legacy. Like these are our mm-hmm. legacy books. This is what launched our company, and we made the wrong decision to renumber. And then
I agree, and I also think that as DC was launching and continuing New 52. Even before that, certainly, but during that 5-year time period, we saw a lot of Marvel going overboard with the relaunches. So Marvel definitely, as DC was busy with New 52, I think that all the comic companies have kind of seen now, okay, I think that fans are kind of over the constant relaunching of books. And Marvel was the one that kind of paid the price for that, you know, by doing it so often when some of the other publishers maybe were in the middle of other endeavors. But I mean, the biggest...
Marvel abused it.
They abused it badly because...
And they abused it for... it's totally for the dollar. Like, they didn't abuse it like, oh, we're relaunching a universe. They abused it just because they knew a number one would get pushed with that plus multiple covers.
They made a lot of mistakes.
They've desensitized the consumer. So it's like, well, it works less and less now.
They launched titles as Secret Wars 2 was going/ending. So as soon as it was over, they said, okay, we're going to start number ones again. So, I mean, you know this. You had All New Hawkeye, Ant-Man, a couple other ones that were literally only, like, I think, Hawkeye was only, like, 4 issues or 5 issues. And they turned around and issued a new number one, same creative team, same exact storyline.
Yeah.
Literally picking up from the previous issue, but making a number one. That was the most grievous, you know, example of that.
Yeah,
I think that was at the point where people... really, really got tired of it.
Well, like Rocket Raccoon, he's had 2 volumes in the same year.
Right.
Yeah, there was a number of them like that. Yeah.
You can't have something with between 4 and 6 issues of a title and then relaunch it again.
Because how do you even describe it to somebody? You have to say volume 6 because you can't say 1994. You know, it's 19
and you
volumes
can't even,
in that.
You can't even tell somebody, go pick up that new number one issue because it's literally number 7 in the series.
That other one could still be there.
Yes.
You have to be really descriptive. Not only that, but it really, as a reader, if you're not, if you don't go Google and find stuff, you could read stuff out of order by accident.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got to be on top of it.
Oh, my gosh, it's crazy.
Yeah. All right, well, let's kick this off, Chris. Why don't you kick us off since you missed last week?
Okay.
We missed you, buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I listened to you guys.
But now your yard looks better than mine, so.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, and to finish my earlier thought, I do enjoy some new comics. I just don't feel I need to be up to date, you know, and it kind of, I stopped reading Rebirth stuff, and for long enough that now there's trades coming out that I've either haven't read the entire thing, or I've read a couple issues, and so I'm just kind of picking up where I left off with trades, and it doesn't really bother me that I'm behind, and I do, I find that I end up rating more stuff at like a 3 out of 5, where I like it, but I'm not overwhelmed by it. But there are still some 4 out of 5s, 5 out of 5s that I come across, some of the better stuff that, even if it's a quicker read, that it's still, I still feel like I'm getting a decent chunk of story, and, you know, the art's really good and that kind of thing. And I will sometimes, so it's just a combination for me of like, I'll sometimes do the digital sales too. So it's kind of a combination of digital sales and using the library, and just found a way to enjoy newer stuff at a lower cost so that it doesn't affect my opinion of the books as much. And
Marvel
I also
Unlimited,
like,
you're not even that far behind.
Yeah, you have that as well, do you, Chris?
Right, right. And that's basically like, that's how I've been doing any newer Marvel stuff for quite a while now.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the other companies don't have that service, I've found a way through the library and through digital sales to kind of do something similar with other publishers too. Mostly DC, because this year mostly it's what I've read is DC, but because there was a lot that I liked about Rebirth and just wanted to, and so it's not that I was hating it, so I did want to take advantage of an opportunity to continue along with my reading.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I'm behind it, I'll actually end up being reading more, because certain Rebirth titles that I didn't care for as much, if I can get from the library, then I'll still check it out just to see what's going on. Whereas if I was buying it, there were certain titles toward the end that I cut. But yeah, there's still some really good stuff there, though, like Wonder Woman, Detective Comics, Deathstroke, you know, so it's cool to still be able to read those just a little bit behind.
But when you're behind, I get into these phases where I almost like to be behind, because the experience is so much different when you read a chunk than if you just read 20 pages and then you wait a month.
Yeah.
You remember, for one thing, it's just not, it doesn't just go into short-term memory. Like, you remember more when you read a bigger chunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, that's the mode I've been in now. I'm the rabbit hole guy, and you'll see from my picks that I'm reading like chunks now. So
yeah, it's more like watching a movie than a TV show.
Yeah.
You know, like I read a trade, it's usually a contained story, or a contained story and then a one shot or something, and it's kind of like watching a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I literally get, like, stress. I feel stress if I'm too far behind on my current comic books.
Yeah.
If there's a day that we're busy and I literally have only, like, either haven't read anything or maybe I got one comic book in the morning, I start to get stressed out. I'm like, I need to get home. I need to get home. I need some quiet time. I need to read some comic books.
I don't get stressed until I have to archive away unread comics. I mean, when I have to merge unread comics, that
when you actually see it.
Well, it gives me anxiety if they're out of sight and I don't have to merge them. Then I'm okay. That's the only time I get anxiety, when I'm like, holy flap! I mean, if
I just and it isn't a good thing. It's like I'm supposed to
be doing this
for enjoyment and for pleasure, and I literally start feeling anxious.
I mean, I can identify with the need for quiet time, especially after socializing, because I'm an introvert for sure, which some people equate that with being like antisocial, but it's not. They're two different things. An introvert, like, I still like to socialize, but it drains me rather than sustains me. So after a while, I'm done, you know?
Yep.
Like, I need to be away, like, I need quiet time, like, but it's not connected to, and I think it's just being an introvert, but I think there's something separate there that, like you said, it's maybe not a good thing, like, because there's really no, you know, I don't feel like there's a need, like, to stay up to date, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I cause it myself, too, by buying so many that it's like I have to read literally, like, 6 current books a day just to keep current. So either I need to scale back, or I need to do like Mike does and not be worried about that and just read as you decide to. Mm-hmm. But because of my personality, it's like I have to keep up. I have to keep current. So then I'm stressing myself out. But I constantly keep buying more and more comic books.
Yeah.
I don't get stressed with all the back issues that accumulate. That's fine. Right. I can read them whenever I want to. But I feel the need that I have to keep up on the current stuff.
Yeah,
I don't have that problem at all, because I'm already three issues behind on every DC comic.
I thought you were gonna say 3 years.
Well, no, I'm like on Rebirth. If you go back, yeah, maybe 10 years, but but I was keeping caught up, and what I'm finding is I don't enjoy the books as much. So to get my maximum entertainment, I do what I do.
Which is why we don't have a DC Weekly Reads.
That's right, exactly.
Because you just have...
Well, it's two things that's driving that. It's that and time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I listened to like the first 10 or 15 minutes this morning of the new Mike M's Reads.
Yeah.
And you were talking about that, and I was just kind of laughing to myself, because I knew at some point, just the way that you read and the way that you don't want to have to have any sort of structure to what you have to read, I knew that eventually you would not be current on DC anymore, and that DC Weekly Reads would fall by the wayside. I just knew it was going to happen.
You've seen it happen in the past.
I've seen it happen in the past. It always happens.
I am Geek Brunch is the easiest to do. DC Noise is easy to do because you just show up.
Like, yeah.
You just show up. This stuff I could control. I can read anything.
Right.
Like Geek Brunch, I could read anything. Usually me and Bill coordinate some random stuff, but we read anything.
Yeah,
and Gotham by Geeks is even tough, because I have to select some. Like, there's a lot of stuff to select from, but it has to be Batman related.
Maybe you don't want to read Batman.
I don't want to read Batman. I'm into Spider-Man now.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you need very, very loose.
I am tough. So you could see like why, like I could have kept Valiant Podcast going, but I couldn't. You got to keep moving. So you can see what I can continue with and what I'll eventually drop just by the structure.
Right. Cuz like a specific comic company or a specific comic character, that's still too narrow for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 10 years or older is fine, because you have from like the 1940s to 2007 to choose from, like any character, any company. Like, it's just, you've got, you know, 70 years or whatever.
Well, DC Weekly Reads was Daryl's idea. And
I totally understand. You know, like Chris said, I kind of knew also, and you could hear it. In your, even in the last like four or five of them too. Like, oh, well, you know, I had a scramble to read it. I'm like, oh God, this isn't going to last for too much longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people thrive on that. You know, like structure and keeping caught up. And I just, for me and entertainment wise, I like to go at my own pace. Like if it's work, I'm totally structured. But when I'm in with my entertainment, I do not want to be structured with my entertainment. I want to go anywhere I can possibly go based on my mood.
Yep.
Yeah, you're completely on that end. I'm definitely more structured in that I create projects for myself, like reading post-crisis DC in order. Like, yeah. I'll create those things for myself, but I'll give myself enough leeway that I can dip into that when I want to, you know. And then there's Rob, who has anxiety about not reading his new comics.
But we all get along. We're all different, but we get along.
Yeah.
And this show, I think you could choose to do any of those. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't keep caught up, but you could be structured in what you pick. I mean, you could
just
go off on a flash tangent for 2 years if you wanted to.
Yeah. And it's old. It's older. It doesn't touch on Rob's, because he's not as anxious about his old comics.
Yeah. He's a little more relaxed on this podcast. If we
were
doing
right.
a podcast, he'd be angry. He'd be like,
well, that's why I couldn't. Like, some of the other times, like when Nerdy Legion was just starting, you know, like Nick and Martin wanted to read something or whatever. I'm like, I don't have time to read that, because I have all these new ones that I need to read. And like, yeah. I didn't have time to like actually dedicate to a whole bunch of other reading, where, you know, here we go every other week or so. And it's, you know, I mean, it's not like it takes hours and hours to read, you know, two or three or four comics, so it's a lot easier. It's very relaxing. It's very fun.
I think Chris has me nailed, though. If you got that from like a couple of lines that I say, you're like, I know him well enough that these things aren't gonna last with Mike.
Well, you guys have been doing this together for a while now, too, haven't you? So he knows you pretty well.
He knows.
Yeah, almost. I think in October it'll be 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Retro. But
I think that's what helps too with me, is I take breaks too. Like if it was had to do it every week, and I couldn't go somewhere 1 week or something like that. Like, I know podcasts that won't skip, and that's even if they're going on to San Diego Comic-Con, they'll find a way to do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I can't do that, no.
Well, no, because, again, you don't want this. This is not your job.
Yeah, it's not my job.
It's, yeah, it's, and that's,
I,
it's your
I don't
hobby.
Get, I don't, if, I, if I got paid, maybe that'd feel more obligation to, like.
Yeah, you might, but you might feel less joy to do it.
That's true. So. This is a time to talk about what I want to talk about with my friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you did it as a job, or if we had ambition to make it our job, we were trying to go that route, you know, like that's the type of thing that I would do, you know, is to have that kind of consistency. But when it is a hobby, then you want to keep things looser so that you can have that freedom, and so that life can come first. And then you have I think that's what allows you to have the longevity. We can keep doing this 5 years later, because you know, if we go through a stretch where we can't do it, we can't do it, but we're relaxed about it, because we know that that's happened before, and we end up getting back to it, and we have our stretches where we do it regularly.
Yeah.
Do-do. You said do-do.
You said do-do.
Yep.
You almost want to do the Beavis and Butthead laugh, you know?
But yeah, there's a couple things. One thing I got to not liking about pre-ordering was you're always, like, when new stuff comes out, you're ordering three issues of it before you even read one, you know? And I got to not liking that, because, like, you might decide that you hate something with the first issue, and then I know, especially with you, Rob, you will not, you if you buy it, you'll read it. So, you know, like, you'll hate read Man-Thing until it's over with. You know, it might be the worst comic book you've ever read, but because you bought it, you'll read it, you know, until
I've experienced
where you dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
It you was know, horrible. So
did you read this, Mike?
No, but
R.L. Stein's Man-Thing.
I like Man-Thing, and I know he
I was excited to read. I was excited to read it. It was horrible. But by the time, to your point, I read number one, and I already had two and three pre-ordered, Chris. It's a five-issue miniseries.
So
right?
The hell with it. I might as well
I'm like,
get it.
I've already getting three issues, right? It can't get any worse, so I'll buy four and five. Yeah, it was horrible, but even the ending was horrible. So I'll be interested to see what you think, Mike.
Yeah.
Did you buy it?
I did. I like Man-Thing. I have all of Man-Thing stuff. So,
if you really like Man-Thing, then you won't like this.
Well, don't say that, because I like the, I like change too, so I'm okay with
it. I know. I'm really just honestly.
I'm all about execution, like, for what I'm in the mood for. So if he's talking to me at a, and they revamp a character, I'm okay with it. To me, it's all history. So
I just think
this,
it was strange.
This means something, but it didn't sell well. It'll be interesting if this R.L. Stein captures some spark in some people. Because he's got a following.
He does. That's why I was actually kind of excited to see what his take was, but it just didn't work for me. I'll leave it at that.
I don't have the problem that, because I'm already invested in the title, even if it's bad. So I'm like,
yeah.
I want to read the bad. That's where my philosophy changes with you guys, is I want to read the bad as well as the good. and that'll kind of work for you, Chris, too, because, like, if you're doing your history lesson on Flash or something, you're going to get to issues that you don't like.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, so, that I have that philosophy with some stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so
more so with the old stuff, you know. And if I have a low cost of entry, you know, like just like with the Library Rebirth trades, like if you know, some of those titles that I didn't really care for, I'm still interested enough in current DC that if I can read it for free or for the tax dollars that I'm investing in my local library system, then I'll go ahead and read it. But if I had to pay for it through DCBS, then I wouldn't bother, you know. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is just I kind of just have to have the mindset, you know, if I had so much disposable money that I could just have a constant influx of new comics and I could just let them sit until I felt like reading them, then maybe I would, but I don't. So it's, for me, it's kind of like I just have to step back and realize the stuff, it's not going anywhere, you know.
Yeah, you do you. In other words,
yeah.
You do what you get to optimize your entertainment and what you're gonna do. Because everybody's circumstance is different.
Yeah, and so I'm not really missing out on anything. And maybe you can adapt a little bit of this, Rob, to your to help you with your stress. But it's like, you know, it's not going anywhere, you know. And I think what makes that easier for me is that I'm willing to read digital. I don't need to collect it. I don't collect new comics, even if I did buy them physical. I don't know. I don't really have a specific cutoff time of where I don't collect anymore, but I collect older stuff. But so there's that too. I don't mind, like, and that factors in because I can say, well, it's always going to be available, even if it goes out of print, because it's going to be digital. So I can just read it digitally down the road if I actually feel like it down the road, you know?
Yep.
Everything's out there. So anyways, but speaking of old comics in physical format, I will jump into Moon Knight 35. Moon Knight Volume 1, I think. This issue is from 1984. And this is, I think, towards the end of the first volume of Moon Knight. I don't think it went too much longer. It was a $1 cover price because it's a double-sized issue. By Tony Isabella, Kevin.
You're good at picking issues that I don't have. Like, I have almost the entire run, but I don't have 35.
It's like this, like...
It's like an uncanny knack.
I'm a weird savant. Like, it's... I'm an idiot savant, but, like, in a really, really random way that I can find comics that aren't in the collection of this guy in Colorado from across the country.
Right.
If, you know, I could just find a way to...
The Fly appeals to me, Joe.
Yeah, The Fly. He's in this. I don't know if I've read much with him before. This is mostly just in the beginning of the story.
This isn't the Human Fly, though, that had his own title.
This is The Fly. He's been in... I've seen him in Spider-Man.
Yeah,
because the issue starts off with Moon Knight tracking The Fly down, and he says... he goes by the not terribly original name of The Fly. Fought Spider-Man, lost. So his deal at this point, at least, is to break into the homes of rich people when they're on vacation. And I had to laugh because it seems like, maybe this is something you already knew about the character, but it seems like he has actual aspects of a fly. Like, however he got his powers, he has connections to the behavior of actual flies. Because he says he's breaking into a safe in this rich person's house, and he says, he's thinking to himself, I think I smell some rotting garbage in the other room. I'd sure like some of that. No, gotta control myself. Can't let my fly characteristics get the best of me.
I didn't know that.
There's a pile of dog shit over there. I think I'm going to go rub in it for a bit and then get back to the safe.
Mike, you're spoiling the ending. That's how Moon Knight defeats him.
That's weird.
That's weird.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't realize that he had that aspect to him. But so Moon Knight catches up with
him. I take the wings are organic then.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. They kind of look like it. They look, the way that they're drawn are definitely to look like organic wings. They look like big versions of a fly's wings. So he has a fight. Moon Knight catches up and they fight a little bit. The fly pretends to fall over the edge of the building, but he can stick to the wall like Spider-Man can, and so he does it as a surprise to jump back up. The fight ends though with Moon Knight losing. He gets stung. This fly does some kind of move where he waves his wings really fast, and it knocks Moon Knight into the wall. And I guess he has problems with his legs at this time because his buddy Frenchie that is in the helicopter or in the Moon Knight ship or whatever above has to go down and help him because he's laying there and he can't stand. So he helps him back and he actually takes him to the hospital. And I think Moon Knight, he had the whole, like, did he already have the whole multiple identities thing going on at this time? Because Frenchie earlier is calling him Mark, but then when he's at the hospital, they're referring to him as Stephen Grant.
I think he has the multiple identities, but they were aliases of his own choosing.
Like,
okay, yeah, I think
and,
you're
and
right.
In
yeah,
other words, he had aliases, and he did them for a reason, more like a,
right.
a spy reason, than he actually went nuts and assumed these personalities like he does later.
Gotcha. Yeah, that sounds right. So yeah, his friends are at the hospital, and they're saying that there's a chance that he might not walk again. So the fly is just kind of in that early part. There's the real antagonist we get introduced in Paris, this young woman who has control of, it seems that she has control of wind powers. She attacks a 17-year-old girl named Maria Andreyanova. Maria Andreyanova. Say that 10 times fast. She attacks her. She's a dancer. And it seems that that's related to the motivation of this other woman that you see on the cover with, she's got like a purple headband and short black hair, and she wears like a white fur coat. She seems to be attacking her because she's a dancer, and she actually sends her up flying into the sky. There's several panels where Maria disappears basically like a balloon, like a helium balloon somebody let go of, and it's this other woman that sends her up like that. So then we get back to Moon Knight. He's, as a civilian, he's trying to recuperate, trying to go through physical therapy and all of that. And actually, some time passes, and it seems that he's involved in sponsoring ballet performances, and they go and they meet a young star, Sergei Valberg. His name is that he's signing some autographs and stuff, and he's doing a practice session, getting ready for this Russian ballet that is going to be performed. And like I said, Steven, or Moon Knight, going by the name Steven, is involved. And while he's there, this woman that we saw attack the other dancer in Paris, she arrives with a gust of wind, blows the doors open, and attacks this Sergei guy. So Moon Knight's in a wheelchair. He tries to get away, tries to do something about it, but he's struggling. And this woman, as she's attacking Sergei, she explains that she is a mutant, that the powers that she has is the result of, you know, being born with them and stuff. And you'll see on the cover it says featuring the X-Men and the Fantastic Four, so that's kind of how they end up getting pulled in. So she goes through a bit of her origin story. And it turns out that the Sergei was a teacher of hers, but part of her mutant awakening was that she grew. She's actually 7 feet tall now, and that kind of ruined her goals of being a ballerina, because there's real like specific size and weight requirements and stuff for ballerinas. And so, but she realized that she had these wind powers, and she's that's why she's on the attack and attacking these people and stuff. So while she attacks her former teacher, Moon Knight pretty much just kind of has to watch from the outside as this happens. Because of his legs, he's struggling to be able to do anything about it. And there's quite a bit, you know, as he later tries to recover further. He's wearing the Moon Knight costume without the cowl. in the wheelchair trying to struggle to stand, and he finally manages it to try to go after this woman. He actually goes to Xavier's school and as Moon Knight and talks to Professor Xavier about this woman. Her name is Bora, and Professor X has heard about her, gives Moon Knight some insight, thinking, you know, that her, he thinks that her powers must be psionic, and that she actually, she doesn't actually control wind, but actually creates them. So the last sort of sequence of the story, the last scene, is the opening of this big ballet, and the Fantastic Four are there, which you find out that Nightcrawler is there. Professor X sent some of the X-Men to kind of keep an eye on things, make sure that there isn't any danger, and Nightcrawler's you can see that the people that are sitting next to him are kind of looking at, out of the corner of their eye at him, because he's not disguised or anything. But he's dressed in a tux, and then he gets a tap on the shoulder, and it's the Thing. Thing's got a cigar in his mouth. The guy's like, on second thought, maybe I wouldn't tell him this is a non-smoking section. This guy with glasses sitting behind him. And so there's some of the X-Men there. It looks, I think, just Nightcrawler, Colossus, Professor X, and Storm. Kitty Pryde is there too, because she says, doesn't the Thing look funny, Peter? Da, Katja. But Fantastic Four are there. Johnny Storm has fallen asleep. And before the Things even start, or the ballerina, the ballet has even started. And so there's a lot of people on the watch, basically. And Bora does attack not long into the start of Things. And Storm wants to get right into it, but Professor X holds her back, and Mr. Fantastic holds Johnny Storm back. Basically, they're there as backup for Moon Knight, and Moon Knight jumps onto the stage and tries to do something about it, and they do actually, as a result of the information that her powers are psionic, they create a bunch of noise to disrupt her concentration. But there's so much, she's causing so much damage with her wind powers that the Fantastic Four and the X-Men do get involved in keeping people safe and trying to minimize some of the damage and stuff, and, you know, getting people out of there. Like, Kitty starts phasing people through the walls, and the Thing holds up a balcony to keep it from falling. Colossus comes to help him, and Nightcrawler gets into the fight to distract Bora long enough that Moon Knight can get a it must be like a rag with some kind of chemical to knock her out. So he puts her to sleep, basically, and that's the end of the story. But pretty much it ends with Moon Knight back at his mansion, and, you know, he's kind of realizes that what he does is important, and that he's not going to struggle with whether he should quit or not anymore. But so overall, I thought it was an interesting story. I wouldn't have thought that, you know, that the concept of the connection to the ballet and all of that would, I didn't necessarily expect that, but Isabella was able to make it interesting, and I thought that the art was pretty good. Well, the only complaint I would say is that Bora is only supposed to be 14, and she definitely looks like she's like in her early 20s. I would say, you know, she definitely doesn't look like she's 14, and I wouldn't have known that was her real age if it didn't say so in the captions. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's supposed to be kind of important to the way that she behaves and to help explain that, and also explain where she's at in her life, that, you know, she started at an early age in training in the ballet, and that she's still young enough that she's still dealing with the way that turning into a mutant, ruining her chances at ballet, affected her. But other than that, though, that would probably be the only negative to the art. So, yeah, pretty interesting. And I guess, what was I saying here? I thought, like I said, I don't think that the title ran for too much longer, but...
Yeah, it looks like it ended at like 38. Yeah, 38.
Yeah, so pretty close to the end. But I don't think they were planning that, because it doesn't feel like it's really setting that up or anything. So.
Yeah, it looks like Tony Isabella only did one issue prior to that. That was his only one issue. And then some Alan Zelenitz came and finished the series off. And I never heard of that guy. Although it looks like those books at the end are... must be rare, because they're expensive.
Lower print run, something. Yeah. The back, it's kind of funny. The whole back cover is a announcement for the next issue instead of an ad.
But
it's black and white. Important announcement. Next issue, you will join Dr. Stephen Strange in witnessing the events that will change Moon Knight's life forever. And it's got an image of Steven's head. He's holding his hands over his eye of Agamotto coming out of his forehead. And Moon Knight's sort of rising up out of his hand. So it says, Moon Knight 36, on sale November 29th, 75 cents. A small price to pay for an experience. I thought that phrase was interesting. Like, it's not good experience, not bad experience. Just
for an experience.
$0.75 is worth it if you get an experience. You got 75 cents?
It's a big difference, though. $3.99 for an experience or 75 cents for an experience.
Yeah.
Very true.
So that's Moon Knight 35. It's a double-sized issue. So.
You know what? You were just mentioning that, like, the back page didn't have an ad. When did regular ads kind of stop in comic books? It kind of took me by surprise. I was looking through, like, the current DC ones, and really the only ads that they have are for their own comic books.
Right.
When did those ads...
Every now and then you'll get an ad for a car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once in a while they'll have a specific targeted ad, like those annoying Twix ones that DC did last year.
They've been doing those a lot, like comics that are like a 2 pages of comic that's an ad. Those are disruptive to me, because sometimes it almost blends with the comic and you're like, oh, this is an ad. You're like, oh, shit.
Did you used to wonder why there was so much written about Hostess back in the day?
Why are they dealing with a Twinkie now?
Why are they constantly eating Hostess cupcakes in these comic books?
Right.
I think it's been like the last 10 years. I feel like the last decade or so.
Yeah, in the 2000s, like mid 2000s, and then it's
funny. It really just
because you still have video games, and now video games don't even go there.
Nope, nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
every once in a while, like the outside cover, like of some current Marvels, is M&Ms, but it's because they're advertising Guardians of the Galaxy. On the M&Ms, you know what I mean?
I think it's twofold. I think they they make the ad so damn expensive that nobody wants to do it for what they think they can get for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then nobody's interested in that market because they see the numbers. I mean, you have to freaking go to the numbers to see. Like,
yeah.
Once you're past 80,000, you're not reaching that many people.
No, you're not.
If you're not in the top 20 books, then it ain't worth your while. Unless your demographic is 100 to 200, you know, like even when you get to the bottom, if you want to try to get 100 to 200 people and you think if you can build people to buy that, then maybe it's worth your while. But Like if you go to Alterna Comics, there's people advertising it, and I bet you it's cheap, and it's like people that have a podcast and stuff like that.
Right.
But I don't think it's wide reaching. I think you even have a better chance of advertising on a blog or a, you know, some kind of website than you would this sort of.
Yeah, thing. It's always going to go where the eyes are, and it's definitely tied to the circulation numbers. It just got to a point where comics don't get enough in front of enough eyes, and it's tied into the internet and people being online. Like, that's where the advertising is, because
right, they'd rather spend on a YouTube video or something like that, because people are going to hit it a million times than a comic that has a circulation of 20,000. Why would they? Because even when if they get the comic in 20,000 hands, it might only appeal to a fraction of that, you know, like 10% or whatever. So now they've even diminished. It's diminishing returns.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And advertisers are smart. They know where their money's coming from.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in this day and age, they have so much
metrics,
data about...
Yeah,
they have so much data about how their advertising is going out. They have more data than they possibly ever need. Algorithms and...
Well, Mike, let me know when you need me to send you that money through PayPal for our ad in Alterna Comics.
Yeah, we'll appeal. They're not even in the top 300, so.
Well, still though, that's the same deal though. Like, people that do get sponsorship for podcasts and stuff, like, you have to show, hey, this is how many download numbers we have.
Yeah.
You know.
Right,
because it all goes to the numbers. You know, you're not going to get a sponsor if it's not worth it to them if you don't have enough listeners. You know,
exactly. Well, if you want, I can go next.
Yeah.
All right. So what I'm going to talk about first is Brave and the Bold number 153, starring Batman and the Red Tornado. And I mentioned this a little bit on Twitter yesterday, but this is actually the second Brave and the Bold comic book I ever bought from the convenience store in the corner of the house that I grew up at. First one was the issue prior, which was with the Atom. And I had it, I think maybe I looked through it, or maybe I read it once. And then the kid across the street, who was the same age as me, he wanted to make a trade for something else, a different comic that I wanted. So I traded him. And then as I kept buying these, I realized how much I loved Brave and the Bold. And I kept on asking him to trade something back, and he refused until and it drove me crazy.
That happened to me a couple times.
Oh my God, insane. And like, just knowing that he had that thing, and you know, at that point, you know, actually 1979, this is when it came out, I was seven. So it's not like there's any way to really go back and get this issue again. Probably about 10 years later, he's like, you know, he was long out of comic books, but he had like a little box of comics. He's like, here you go. And he handed me all the comic books. And of course that was in there. So I finally got it back.
It took 10 years. I bought this issue off the spinner rack too.
This one that we're talking about?
Yeah. 153.
Oh my God.
I didn't have a lot of Brave and the Bold. I had like 10 issues, but I kept every one of them. I didn't trade any of them away.
Yeah, this was like my golden age of buying comics, and especially Brave and the Bold was my, at that point, probably my favorite series. Of course, it didn't last too long.
If you only knew some of the comics that were in my hand at age 7 that I got rid of, you would scream bloody murder.
Why would you get rid of them?
Because I didn't like to read them. They were Stan Lee and Ditko, and I wanted to read the new stuff, man. They were more sophisticated.
Well, I kept up with this series right up until the end with very few I had some holes for sure that I just recently finished filling, but from here all the way through to the 190s, I had most of the issues. Because I loved this series, and Mike, I don't know if you saw me. I post this actual comic on Twitter yesterday. Oh my God, it is beat to hell, but that's okay.
Well, mine is beat pretty bad, but it's mostly the binding.
Mine is binding, but I got a lot of
there's creases. cracks and creases all over it. Yeah.
Yep. But so this one is Batman and the Red Tornado. The writer is Kerry Burkett, and the artists are Don Newton and Bob Smith. And what we start out with is some sort of strange creature crashes into a businessman's office way up in a top floor somewhere, and you hear him just scream, and then it cuts to the later that day where Batman and the police and Commissioner Gordon are investigating the scene. And Batman notices several things, including like metal filings and a faint smell of oil. And so he deduces that it wasn't a human being that killed him, but somehow something climbed up to this top story, broke the window and killed this man. So he goes to investigate, but first he has to go to a charity event that he's hosting, of course. And the guy who was killed, his name is Gibson, and his partner Rand is at the charity ball. So he starts talking to him, and Rand finds out that Gibson's been killed, and he's visibly shaken and has to excuse himself and runs off. So Batman as Bruce Wayne goes to the office of Gibson and Rand, and they're actually involved in computer-controlled probes for exploring Mars. So just as he gets there, he hears a scream coming from an office, and the secretary runs out of the other way, and so he changes into Batman and goes running in. And just as he gets there, Red Tornado comes from somewhere and bumps into him and knocks him over. From this page on, I don't remember exactly where this is in Red Tornado continuity, but he's constantly apologizing and second-guessing himself. So I'm not quite sure what's going on with Red Tornado, but he has a lot of serious self-doubt at this point. And they encounter these...
Probably from Justice League.
Yeah, it has to be.
His miniseries was much later.
Yeah, that was like in the 80s. Right?
Yeah, his miniseries is when he had a family. Kind of like the Vision. Yeah.
I remember that. Mm-hmm. Red Tornado flies into the office, and there's these two strange-looking robots, and they quickly grab Red Tornado and smash him against the wall and kind of bust him up pretty good before they escape. So, you know, Batman checks on Red Tornado, and of course Red Tornado is whining that he's failed his duty, and Batman even says, "Don't whine about it, Reddy." He's like, "Pull yourself together." So they both go running after these robots, and they see that they've smashed into an experimental lab that actually is simulating a Martian terrain. So the robots are there. Batman now is attacking them while Red Tornado's getting a hold of himself. And they manage to grab Batman and start squeezing onto him. And so he throws an acid vial on the robot, but he feels he's going to be squeezed to death before the acid takes effect. But Red Tornado manages to get a hold of himself and flies in with his tornado powers, basically blows the robots against the wall, and one of them is destroyed, the one that the acid finally ate through. And the other one ends up getting away. So they go ahead and they start investigating the robot that they have, and they learn that there was a Dr. Tarr that was part of this whole program that no longer works there. And Red Tornado doesn't seem to have He knows who Dr. Tarr is, and he was going there actually for a checkup just to get his circuits cleaned, but he doesn't seem to have any type of memory that Dr. Tarr has been had an accident and has been let go. So that seems strange. They go back to Gibson to try to get more information, and what they find is that Tarr had been too careless with a lot of his experiments. And there was an accident that affected his mind and body, and he had to cover himself in wrapping. And what happened was Red Tornado actually went there, as he said, to get himself checked out, and Dr. Tarr actually wiped his programming of his memory that he had gone to see him, and actually did some experiments on his power, so on his actual power source. He decided to use that type of power source on these new robots that he's using to destroy the project, because he's upset with these two that he was let go, Gibson and Rand. He wiped his memory so he wouldn't realize that, and Red Tornado, not remembering that, went back again to the center to get himself cleaned up, not remembering that he had just been there prior. But the problem is that the power source that he mimicked from Red Tornado was not perfected. He didn't perfect it correctly, and the robots are going to explode after time. So they've deactivated the one robot. They have to decide where else to go. So since he doesn't have access to his library or his laboratory here at the center, they said, well, he's a creature of habit. He's probably going to go back to where he got his PhD, the Gotham University. So they both, Red Tornado and Batman, go there. Sure enough, Tarr and the one robot is still there. They try to get him to listen, saying, we have to deactivate this robot. It's going to explode in a few seconds, but Tarr doesn't believe him. So Batman disables Dr. Tarr, and Red Tornado, through Batman's encouragement, actually links up with the robot. And because they have similar power sources, he's able to actually drain the excess energy coming out of the robot and absorbing it into himself, keeping the entire robot from exploding. And that's really the end. Tarr is just captured, the robot is disabled, and then it just says next issue, Batman and Metamorpho. And I remember that issue as well. And I have a little joke for you as well from the Hembeck section. Did you guys hear about Saturn Girl? No?
What
no.
about Saturn Girl?
She has rings around the collar.
Ah.
Wow.
Do you remember those little Fred Hembeck cartoons? Yeah. The yeah. back with Answer Man and stuff? Mm-hmm. I used to love those, yeah.
Ask the Answer Man.
Yes, ask the Answer Man.
Even though the answers were kind of not always great.
No, but it was fun to read, especially when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have the
internet back then, so like no, an answer was a big
know
deal.
Know any of this stuff. Yeah, and then they'd ask him how much. Certain issues
were worth,
I used to love reading those. This was a enjoyable, fun issue. It was nothing to shake the world over. And honestly, if I would have read this for the first time now, I probably wouldn't think much of it. But because it's something that I literally read when I was 7 years old and probably read over and over again back then, it just brings back a lot of memories. So it's real fun going back and reading one of the first DC comic books that I ever bought.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I've been real theme-oriented lately. It seems like when Guardians came out, I talked about Guardians. When it was Memorial Day, I focused on Memorial Day. Well, Spider-Man Homecoming came out. So I'm going to talk about Spider-Man.
And, nice.
I read these issues. This is interesting because if you buy the Spider-Man, I own the singles, but it's easier to read the collected. I have Spider-Man by Todd McFarlane Omnibus, and these were the last two I needed to finish. So in the last two stories in this Omnibus are issues 16 of Spider-Man, and believe it or not, they included X-Force number 4, which isn't even Todd. It's Rob Liefeld. It's a crossover between the two books starring X-Force and Spider-Man. And back in the when this happened, this was like a big deal to me. Like, for one thing, McFarlane and Liefeld, when they were at Marvel, it was just eye-catching. Like, it was eye candy to me. Like, a big deal. And what's really cool, though, that I had a retro feel on this is, like, I was reading this, and I was like, man, when they came out with the Marvel action figures back in the day, I had a lot of these characters. Like, I had Shatterstar, I had Gideon, like, I remember having the Gideon. I still have the Gideon toy. What am I talking about, remember having? It's downstairs in the basement. But this is an interesting story from a couple of perspectives. One is September 11th. This is before September 11th. This came out of roughly around 1991, a decade before. But Black Tom and Juggernaut were destroying the Twin Towers, most specifically Black Tom. And Cable was there to try to stop it from happening. It decimated one of the towers already. And Spider-Man just happens to swing in and work with Warpath, Feral, and Shatterstar, and Cannonball to try to take down the Juggernaut. It's interesting to watch the McFarlane videos. I don't know if you watch them when he draws on the little light board or whatever you want to call it, screen.
Yeah.
But I really like it. And one thing you'll notice is his accent when he says
things. When he talks?
Yeah.
I was going to say, part of the reason I love watching his videos is just listening to him talk.
Well, in this one, if you've watched those videos and then you read the dialogue, you're like, wow, this is really Todd. So that I found that fascinating. But Cable's working with Domino to go after Black Tom. And Gideon's there, and he's really against what Cable's doing. Sunspot's there also, but he's in the background. But what I really liked about this, it was just an action issue. Juggernaut's really racial in this issue. He can't stop talking about Warpath being an engine. But they have a rough time, and you forget about how powerful Juggernaut is. You know, like, he could heal really, really fast. And one of the things Shatterstar does is he just whips out both of his blades and jams them right into his eyes. He just right into his eye sockets. And then that literally pisses off Juggernaut, but he realizes that he'll heal, and sure enough, he heals by the time Liefeld gets a hold of him. But the other thing I noticed is the attention to detail between the two artists. McFarlane put a lot of detail in everything, and Liefeld abstracted it with color and stuff. Mm. Like, he won't even complete the webbing on Spider-Man. Like, he'll show, like, lighting or something so he could not have to draw each one of the webs.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always made fun of, a matter of fact, there's a Hempback cartoon in this that came out of Marvel Age that's in this collection. There's actually a Marvel Age comic in here, which is a lot of articles about Todd McFarlane taking over Spider-Man and stuff. And it has a Hempback cartoon, speaking of Hempback. And he's making fun of it. It's actually Spider-Man talking to Marvel saying, I can't work with this McFarlane guy because he contorts my body all over the place. He's moving my leg over here. I can't do that. I'm spreading the legs like this. And he's complaining. And then, but Marvel then shows the Mary Jane pictures, and he's like, oh my god, I get to go come home to this. And he changes his whole mind about being drawn by Todd McFarlane. But as I see, like, the poses that McFarlane is in, like, he put Spider-Man in, they look, even though they're exaggerated, they look like something out of a spider, whereas like Liefeld, when he did it, it looks really awkward. Like it doesn't look natural or organic at all. It looks like he's contorted, like really contorted. So I enjoyed it, but it's a product of its time. It's weird how they decimated the Twin Towers, and then a decade later it kind of happened. Even they destroyed one of the towers. They didn't destroy both of them. And you never really know, reading these two issues in this crossover, what instigated Black Tom and the Juggernaut, because that was probably in issue 3 of X-Force. So you don't get that here. But and then Siren is also in it too. So it was a really cool issue. One thing, even though Liefeld has done, like he created Cable and stuff, if I take a picture of you and show you how he drew Cable here, it looks really bad.
Really?
It looks like he took a dump in his shorts.
Maybe he did. Maybe that's what he was going for.
But back then, it was awesome. Like, I didn't think about it, but now that I'm looking at it and critiquing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a question. I read both of these. Back in the day, I got these both off of the newsstand or the at the comic shop, because I was big into these guys back then. I think with McFarlane, he, like, there's that old thing that you say, like, if you know the rules, you can break them, you know. And I think McFarlane knows anatomy, and I never had a problem with, and I still don't have a problem with the way that he would pose Spider-Man, like you said, because of his power. I always thought that it fit his powers, that
it
he
looked
would
organic great. Didn't it
yeah it looked like something that he would do, being a Spider-Man.
But I think with Liefeld, I don't think, you know, he didn't have any formal training, and I don't think he had the same understanding of anatomy that McFarlane does, and so it's like he was breaking the rules without knowing them in the first place, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I wanted to ask both of you, so Chris, you were starting to get into that, but at the time when these were coming out, were either one of you collecting X-Force, and how long did you collect it before you stopped, or did you go right through to the end of the run?
X-Force, well, I got out of...
Go ahead.
Well, I can answer quickly, because I got out of comics like early 90s. I dropped everything when the Image creators left. I was all about the art when I was a kid. And so when they formed Image, I dropped everything Marvel.
Oh, wow.
Just went over and bought the first few issues of the stuff from Image. And then I quit comics altogether until like college.
Interesting. Okay. And how about you, Michael?
I can
Michael?
Tell you exactly when I dropped off, because it's in my database.
Me too, and I'm interested to see what you say.
I stuck with it until issue 35 and then dropped off.
Boy, I was a glutton for punishment. I stuck with it until issue 50. I bought issue 50, and when I took it off of my pull list at the comic shop, everyone literally turned and started clapping. I am not lying. They actually started clapping. Like, you should have done that a while ago, buddy. Like, wow.
I really like this title. I have nothing to be ashamed of. It was what it was, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. As a matter of fact, I prefer this Deadpool to the Deadpool that is the jokey Deadpool.
Well, I agree with that. But we didn't.
Never could get into that mode that made him popular. You know, I was more into this Deadpool.
He became popular when I was kind of out of Marvel for a little bit. Like, I was still buying some Marvel, but I wasn't buying a ton of Marvel. And so it's something that I never understood. Like, well, when did Deadpool become popular? I remember him just as a side character from
Kelly and Gail Simone.
Right? And it like happened when I wasn't paying attention to a lot of Marvel. So.
Well, I think he spoke to people. So, I mean, people that were reading it, that's when he stood out more. Like, I think Deadpool made a a brief cameo in this. I'm trying to find it. He appeared very briefly, and he did make like a witty remark, because I remember it stood out. I was like, huh. Because I'm wondering where, like, exactly when he really morphed to, but...
Wasn't that Joe Kelly that was responsible for that?
Yeah, Joe Kelly, and mostly. Then Gail Simone continued it. And he's doing it now. Like, at least he was doing Spider-Man Deadpool.
Yeah.
So he came back to it, that...
I just don't think that... I'm not a fan of Deadpool either, but I don't think before they did give him that aspect, I don't think there was anything really unique about him. You know, I don't think there was anything that stood out about him, because he was just kind of a generic character and kind of a, you know, Liefeld just wanted to create his own Deathstroke.
Yeah.
He didn't even, you know, Grant Wilson, or not Grant, but
Slade Wilson.
Slade Wilson. And what's Deadpool's name? Wade Wilson. Yeah, Slade Wilson, Wade Wilson.
Well, Deadpool, all of his characters, even when he went to Youngblood, could be mapped to an X-Force member. Including, like, G.W. Bridge, his Chapel. I mean, you could...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're right.
He has his own Cable, you know. He's got several of them, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
All right, so I also read Challengers of the Unknown number 73.
Oh.
This is a 15-cent comic from 1970.
Can you say that again? 73 I got, but I didn't get the title.
Challengers of the Unknown.
Oh, okay.
15-cent comic. And...
I bet you I don't have it.
That's why he's covering it.
Yeah. I gotta ask you guys, pause now and contemplate the enormity of the universe. Ponder how little man knows and prepare to meet the curse of the killer time forgot.
Uh-oh.
So this is A Trip into Another Reality by Denny O'Neill and George Tuska. And it starts off with a capsule, one of those capsules that they use for space travel, or that like disconnects from a spaceship, and they're monitoring it at Cape Kennedy, and so then they send out a ship to retrieve it, and they open it up, and the astronaut that's inside is dead. He's been strangled, and they're like, well, how could he be strangled if he was alone in a ship 10,000 miles from Earth? He's like, well, I don't know, but whatever happened wasn't natural, so there's only one thing we can do is call the Challengers. And so at this time, the Professor Haley, he had... apparently suffered injuries recently and was hospitalized for months. And so he'd been replaced, or, you know, his position on the Challengers team was being held by a woman named Karina Stark. And so Professor Haley is released from the hospital and shows up, and two of the Challengers, Red and I just forgot the other guy's name. the tough guy.
Rocky,
yeah. I knew Red and Rocky, they get into a fight because Red is really horrible to Karina. He's like basically saying, I'm glad that Professor's back. Now we can get rid of this woman. And Rocky has feelings for Karina. So the two of them get into a fight and they start, you know, physical fight. They're going at each other, and then finally Ace Morgan, their leader, shows up and tells them to cut it out. He's the only one that can get them to quit. And he's like, he tells them, we got a mission, so get changed. And Red asks, is Karina coming too? And he's like, yeah, why not? We need all the help we can get. So there's actually five of them. So they meet with the army. They meet this Major Cheever, who tells them about what happened, about this ship coming down. And while they go to the hospital, while they're at the hospital, Karina, she has these kind of minimal psychic abilities. She can't really control it, but every once in a while she gets a sense of a presence or just something like that, that it's not something she can control, but she occasionally can take advantage of it. And she feels this ghostly presence trying to contact them. And so she tries to follow it into this laboratory area, and she goes through this door that's a vacuum chamber, and someone comes up behind her and traps her in there and starts pumping the air out of there. Fortunately, the other challengers find her in time to pull her out. Well, Rocky actually has to take a bench or something like that. It looks like he smashes his way through the door, and they get her out of there just in time. And right after this, they find two guards. It looks like somebody, both of them are dead. It looks like somebody tried to make it look like they shot each other, but they must have had to work quickly because they did a bad job. Ace is able to look at it and figure out that one of the soldiers wouldn't have been shot in a particular way, etc. So he kind of examines their wounds. And so they don't really have a lot of leads to go on, and Karina says that she could actually lead them in a seance, and they could try to contact the presence that she felt. And Red straight up thinks it's ridiculous, and the rest of the team, they're not necessarily thinking that's going to work, but they don't really have anything else to go on. So they're like, well, it can't hurt. So they do that, and she does actually contact this presence. It kind of comes into the room, this sort of pink cloud. It says, and it speaks to them. It says, not human, cursed, linked to Earthman, must kill once more. Name is, and it's about to tell them that when a grenade goes through the window, so they have to duck and cover. And the presence that she feels like the presence that she had summoned to the room is that it had gone up to the moon. So Rocky and the professor have to stay behind as they actually go to the moon. They get in a spaceship. Rocky's got to stay behind because they don't have a pressure suit large enough for him. and the professor, he's not in condition physically yet to go. So Karina actually gets to go with them. And so they go into outer space. And Karina tries to reach out to the presence again. The major Cheever that they originally contacted with, he's with them as well. And once they're in outer space, he pulls a gun, and it turns out that he has been contacted by this presence. When the presence during the seance said something about being connected to, linked to an Earthman, it was this Commander Cheever. And so he's been driven mad, and he is trying to, he pulls out a gun. He's trying to shoot them. They have this battle in this confined space. And the presence arrives, this sort of pinkish cloud. And Cheever introduces it as Machu. And Machu tells them that he and several other of his kind had settled on the moon. They were trying to destroy substances on the moon that were draining their life force, but they weren't able to, and he was the only one that survived. And their leader had like extra abilities or something, and so he, as he was dying, he cursed Machu that he had to remain on the moon until he killed or destroyed two things that were evil. And so he was alone for thousands of years, and then this major chief or in a spaceship came by, space capsule, and connected, he connected with him. And Cheever told him, you should destroy anyone that tries to escape the planet Earth, like anyone that is an astronaut, anyone that tries to go beyond planet Earth and go to other places. And they're like, well, why would you do that? You're an astronaut yourself. And he says that once he realized that there were things out there like Machu lurking, that he thinks that man should not go into space, that they'll be corrupted. So he's kind of got a pretty weird logic going there. Hmm. Well, things take a turn for the better because Machu ends up connecting with Karina's mind again. And Karina, he discovers that humanity isn't all like Commander Cheever. He thought that all he knew of mankind was of Cheever's mind. And when he sees that Karina's psyche is clean and pure and not evil, he understands human morality better. And he actually wraps himself around Cheever, grabs hold of a gun, and he's kind of like inside of Machu. And when he's caused to shoot himself, and so Machu has destroyed one thing that's evil, and that was one of the things of his curse. And so he then he says, I've taken an innocent life, that of the other astronaut, meaning the one that was killed at the beginning of the issue. And so since he's taken an innocent life, he considers himself evil. And so the second evil thing he's going to erase to end the curse is himself. And that's the end of the story. There's a weird 2-page story at the end of the issue. It's really brief. And I'm just thinking that they must have just needed to fill space, because it's called A Flash of Memory. And it's just this guy on a beach. And he's thinking about like how he doesn't know who he is. He's got amnesia. He goes out, he swims out into the ocean or whatever. And he starts to have memories of being a soldier and of his family. And when he was a soldier, he jumped on a grenade and he received a award for heroism and stuff. And he remembers that his name was John Porter. But then he drowns. He's out in the water and he drowns. And the last panel is, it's said that a man's life flashes before him when he drowns. Is there anyone who could confirm or deny such a phenomenon? I mean, you know, there's no way of knowing, I guess, basically saying. And they got the guy's body on the beach and there's a lifeguard standing there. He's saying, anybody know who he is? So it's just a weird 2-page story. But I was looking on Mike's Amazing World and it looks like this was written by the editor, Murray Boltonoff. And looking at issues before and after this, it looks like they would have a page or a 2-page story at the end. I guess just short little things like this, just fill-ins to finish out the page count or something.
Huh.
But I thought it was a fun issue. Well, that was a fun 70s.
Well, they did a lot of stuff like that in the 70s, even with Wonder Woman. They'd have like a 2-page thing on how to get married and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
So it could be just the theme of the title, like the unknown and stuff, like
right,
House of Mystery or House of Secrets.
Yeah, even though like in this case it's not really an anthology, you know, you have like a specific team. They just kind of had the little backup. So
very cool.
But I like that it's you definitely can see the kind of comparison to the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. You know, when they didn't have a spacesuit big enough for Rocky, I was thinking, yeah, that's the kind of thing that would happen to the Thing.
Yeah. Challengers of the Unknown and Doom Patrol. They say Marvel took ideas from that.
Yeah, that's Yeah, the X-Men Doom Patrol thing is always kind of like, no one will ever prove it for sure, but they think that's possible. And with Challengers, I think it was just kind of like Jack Kirby was sort of refining the concept, right? Because wasn't Kirby involved in the Challengers originally? And then, you know, he obviously was a part of Fantastic Four, so I think he was just kind of taking a similar idea and, you know,
expanding on it,
expanding on it, you know, like the Thing is actually like physically deformed and, you know, well, everybody has got their abilities instead of just being like a group of sort of talented adventurers. So,
yeah.
Rob?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm here.
What's next?
All right. So next one I'm going to do is the Spectacular Spider-Man. Number 200, and as it is a product from the early to mid 90s, of course it is a like a foil cover.
Nice,
because it's a anniversary issue. On the cover, it's got Spider-Man and Green Goblin fighting. The creative team, the writer is J.M. DeMatteis. And Sal Buscema is the artist, and I loved his. I loved them together when they did this run of Spider-Man. It was awesome. It's one of my favorite runs. Basically, this issue is the culmination of kind of a subplot that had been going on for maybe a year or so, where Harry Osborn started to become mentally ill again. And it was handled very well over the course of time. It was just very, I don't know what you would say. It was subtle. It wasn't, you know, in your face. It was just starting to have issues and, again. And as I said, this is the culmination where he's on full Green Goblin mode at this point. How it starts out is, basically, Green Goblin, Harry Osborn, is coming after Mary Jane. Mary Jane and Peter are married at this point. Now, at the same time, Peter is looking for Harry all over the place. He's gone to Harry's wife, Liz, and they have a son, Norman Jr., and he's looking for him, and they can't find him, and changes into Spider-Man and starts looking around. Now, Harry knows also, he's found out that Peter Parker is Spider-Man. So Green Goblin grabs Mary Jane and takes her to the Brooklyn Bridge where Gwen Stacy died. I think it was the Brooklyn Bridge, Mike, wasn't it? Or was it a different George Washington Bridge? I don't know. But
I'm not an expert on New York bridges.
me neither, but in either case, it was one of those.
The whole idea is when you read it, you thought one thing, but the snap, you know.
Exactly.
You're like, so, what killed her? you kind of know from the snap.
Yeah, why'd they throw that snap? Webbing, you know, yeah. That was very, I think, you know, looking back, it was probably a controversial move itself. But they went ahead. He drops her off right on the top of the bridge, and they start talking, and she's like, I'm not, you know, if you expect me to beg for my life, you know, I'm not going to do it. And he's like, wait a minute. What? He's like, I'm not here. I'm not here to hurt you. I'd never hurt you. You're one of my dearest friends. Like, that's actually why I brought you up here, is like, I just wanted to let you know that, I actually, you know, I care about you. I care about, Peter's aunt, and I would never, you know, I would never hurt you guys, but at the same time, you know, where Peter's the one that is having the issues, and you know, I just want to let you know that you know, I would do anything for you guys, but it's Peter. He becomes a different person when he puts on the Spider-Man mask, and you know, we've got to do something about him. And, you know, Mary Jane's trying to convince him that it's not Peter, that it's really Harry, and Harry doesn't want to hear anything about it. And she finally, you know, says that, you know, take me home, and he agrees. So, you know, he's very he's very disturbed at this point in the series, and Spider-Man is continuing to look for Harry without any success. He's like, you know what? He's like, I don't know where MJ is either. I hope that she's safe. I'm going to go back to the apartment and hopefully, you know, she's okay. And sure enough, she's there, but so is Harry in his goblin outfit, just without the mask. And as soon as he sees that, that triggers Peter, and he punches Harry across the room and starts grabbing him. And Mary Jane's like, you know, don't stop. This isn't what it was. You know, he just wanted to talk. And Harry's like, you're always thinking the worst of me, aren't you, Peter? And takes off, Peter Parker's mask. And, MJ's probably continuing to try to tell them to get along, to end the insanity and stuff. And Harry's like, it's too late for that. And he's like, but remember what I told you, you have nothing to fear. And he puts his mask back on and says, from the Green Goblin, now you have to excuse me. My wife and son are probably worried about me. He flies off on the glider. So, they're basically, Peter and MJ are basically talking, trying to figure out what's going on. They show Harry come back to the house, and I mean, he's visibly, like, he looks like he's drawn perfectly by Buscema, because he looks absolutely insane. He's got like a big smile on his face, but his eyes are like just totally like wide open, dilated, and he's like sweating profusely and stuff. And apparently he's been sick with a fever, and Liz is trying to tell him to go back to bed and grabs her by the neck and, you know, stop talking to me like that, like I'm weak, and so on and so forth. Then he snaps out of it. He's like, oh, you know, please forgive me. I'm sorry about that. It's just, you know, we're going to be happy together forever, and starts kissing her. But I mean, he's absolutely insane. So basically what's happening here is, over the course of several weeks, Green Goblin just keeps following Peter around in his, you know, Pete's just in his regular identity, and he might be drinking coffee, you know, at a cafe, or reading the newspaper or whatever, and then the Green Goblin's just floating like 20 feet above him, just staring at him, and you know, constantly getting on Peter's nerves. And he's like, you know, what are you doing? You know, if this is a fight, you know, let's get this over with. And he's like, what are you talking about? I don't want to fight. I'm just out, you know, gliding around. He's like, there's no law against that. And then he, you know, glides away. So he's just driving him absolutely insane. So then he ends up, Harry ends up in costume coming to see J. Jonah Jameson. He wants him to take an ad out in the paper and start hyping up his new foundation. It's going to be the Norman Osborn Foundation. It's going to be a charitable foundation. It's going to be a big event at their penthouse on a certain day. So he wants him to publicize it. And he's gone to every newspaper, talk show, et cetera, and talking about this. So talking it up and everything else. So what it comes out to be is, after a brief fight with the Green Goblin on the rooftops, Green Goblin again leaves. And what you find out is that he's going to blow up the entire penthouse with all of these big shots of the city there for this charitable event. And in his mind, that's going to be him getting back at all of these people on behalf of his dad, who wasn't able to do this. So sure enough, it gets to be that particular, it's going to be close to that date. And Mary Jane goes back to the, to talk to Harry some more, and trying to get them to resolve their differences one more time. And he's like, I'd love to, but he's like, love, it's too late for love. It's only power can resolve these conflicts. So what it turns out is that Peter and MJ actually live in a flat, I believe, below Liz and Harry. So that's got to be for some awkward interactions. Hang on. Good night, Allie. Have a good nap, okay? Love you.
Love you too, Dad. Good night, Zach. Have a good nap, okay? I love
you. Good night.
Bye. Everyone says good night. So anyhow, at the penthouse, Spider-Man and Green Goblin start getting into it, and they're fighting and going back and forth, and pretty soon, Harry's able to stab Peter with this needle that totally throws Peter's balance totally off, and he's not able to even like stand. He's like, well, you're not going to, he's like, this isn't going to kill you. I want to do that myself. But guess what? I've decided that you're not going to die alone. He's like, instead of doing this big charitable thing, you know what? I've heard what you said. We keep fighting over and over again. We're not getting anywhere. He's like, let's just end this right now. And he goes ahead and sets off, this timer just to blow up the entire building. And he's like, you know what? We're better off just the two of us just being dead. He's like, everyone we leave in our wake either dies or their lives become miserable. It's better off for the two of us to just die. And Peter's like, you can't do this. He's like, what are you doing? And and Harry says, you know, everyone will be better off without me. And he's like, oh no. It's like Mary Jane Norman. They're still in the building. So Harry's like, they're in the house. And Peter's like, what? Like, what have I done? What have I done? And Peter's like, I can't even stand. No one can save them except for you. He's like, you need to do this. He's like, I'm not a hero. It's like, you're the only one that can do it. So sure, he jumps up on the glider. He grabs both Mary Jane and he grabs Norman Jr. and flies them out of the house. And then the next thing you see is Peter just trying to get onto his feet, and he just can't. And Mary Jane's like, what are you talking about? And Harry says, there's a bomb. The whole building's going to explode any second. She says, my husband's in there? You left Peter to die? He's like, yes, no, I don't know. And Peter just falls back to the ground, and the next thing you see is just the apartment building. And then you see Harry on the glider with Peter in his arms. And it's just no words at all. It's just you see them getting closer and closer to the actual like panel, and then you see the whole place explode. So he's managed to save Peter's life. And they're like, thank you. And Harry just collapses and starts having a convulsion. But what you learn is that he had experimented on the original Goblin formula, and it made him much stronger than what Norman was, but it also has some side effects. And it looks like he ends up, at the very end, he dies. So he's like, I did it, Peter, just the way you would have, a real hero. He's like, why, Harry? Why'd you come back for me? He's like, you're my best friend. And that's the last thing he says before he dies. And just, the last panels are just silent, with them carting him off onto a ambulance, and then Peter just holding Mary Jane, and Mary Jane taking Normie away, and then Peter just like holding his head in his hands, just and just crying, and then it just shows a photo of Harry and Peter back when they were friends, like in high school. So it was a very touching issue. I remember specifically reading this for the first time, just sitting on the floor of my bedroom when I was in college. And like I said, the whole leading up to this issue was just done masterfully. And I absolutely loved how at the very end, that Harry was actually able to overcome his demons and actually save, you know, his best friend and his family from being killed before he died. And of course, as you know, everything's retconned now, but it was just an amazing end to that story. I really, really loved it. And that's all I got to say about that.
Are you... Hey, that sounded familiar. Are you rereading Spectacular all the way from the beginning? Is that what you're working?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, I was missing huge chunks.
You have a full run now, last, don't you?
I'm missing two issues, I think. But basically, what I had done like last year was that big chunk between, like, let's say the teens all the way up to when I started buying them, maybe issue 81. I managed to get almost all those, but for a couple issues. So I just went ahead and read all of those. And then I just decided to pick this up for today because I just remember specifically how much I enjoyed this whole, like I said, it might have been a year or so that Matisse was writing this.
Yeah.
And D. Matisse, and it was just, you know, he had that side story of, you know, just a little bit in every issue, just, you know, highlighting Harry and stuff.
Now he did live in the same building. He's good.
Oh, it's just so well done. And
he did that Kraven arc too. That's really
popular. Oh, I know. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So, you know, I love this and I loved rereading this, but now I got that itch where I've only read this now. This culmination, I want to go back and read from where it kind of picked up these clues that Harry wasn't well again.
Yeah.
And kind of read it from the start again. But yeah, I'm only missing a couple issues. I think it's like issue 5 and 6 or 6 and 7 or something like that. Something. Somewhere around there.
I just placed my comic shop order.
That's one I definitely need to just go out. Actually, it looks like I'm looking now. Looks like the only issue I'm missing is 5.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? And 27, because it's expensive. It's Frank Miller's first Daredevil art.
Yeah. You'll be happy to know that I will have a full... I have issue 4 of All-Star Squadron, which is the only one I was missing. So now all three of us have a full run.
We're All-Star Squadron triplets now.
Yeah, so how about that?
Very nice.
I'm going to talk about something that I didn't read that's Spider-Man related that has a lot of people that didn't like it and a lot of people that did like it. So I'm going to talk about the Clone Saga, and I don't have these issues, but that will be rectified. I own the Spider-Man Clone Saga Volume 1 Omnibus. This honking thing is $125. But what amazes me is the binding. Whoever binds these is amazing because, god dang, these have so many freaking pages. Like, how do you do that? How do you hold these pages together? But this is weird. Like, for me, I've read what happened after this. And I know a lot about Ben Reilly from Clone Conspiracy and everything else that came before this. He even had his own title, The Scarlet Spider, and I read all this. And I know that there's times in the story where you don't know who's the real Spider-Man, like when Peter had doubts if he's the real clone or if it's Ben or what's going on.
Mike, at the time, people were freaking out. Like, if you read the letters columns and stuff,
yeah.
Like, say, you mean to tell me for the past, like, 20 years that I've been reading Spider-Man, it hasn't been
it's real a clone. Peter Parker? Yeah.
Yeah, they were livid. People were out of their minds.
And that's what's weird about this, the way this opens, okay? The issues I'm talking about are Web of Spider-Man 117, Amazing Spider-Man 394, Spider-Man 51, and Spectacular 217. It's the opening arc. But prior to that, there were little short stories in all of those four Spider-Man. Plus, I'm a sucker for arcs that cross titles like this, like when Batman did it and a lot of other titles that do it. I'm just a sucker for these big crossovers within their own title, like intercompany type crossover, like when X-Men does it, it's in the X-Men books, and Spider-Man does it, the Spider-Man books. I never read this, so I like know all this stuff. I dropped off of it. I almost dropped off of Spider-Man when Michelinie left. Michelinie was like a big deal to me in Marvel in terms of Iron Man. In Spider-Man, like Amazing Spider-Man, like I loved his writing. Like, and plus they had like artists, like amazing artists on Amazing. And I lost interest with this. And this But I've always wanted to read this, and I figured, what the hell? This I have this big honking book here, and it's Spider-Man Homecoming. I'm gonna start reading this. So I'm gonna challenge myself to read like an issue a day, and just make it a priority to make it through this and find out what this is about. Mm-hmm. But it opens up really interesting, like it, really in depth, because during this time prior to it, Peter's parents came back, and it was like a hoax through the chameleon, and it like devastated Peter. And he's like in this weird freaking state, like a state I cannot possibly understand. And it's even causing controversy with his marriage and Mary Jane. And he's being weird. Like, it's a jarring book to read because Peter doesn't seem like Peter. Like, it's almost like I'm reading the clone is Peter and Ben is Peter and the clone is the guy that thinks he's Peter. It's really confusing because just the way it's written. And Aunt May has a stroke. And it's a bad stroke. And the thing that really troubled me is that Peter is not acting right about this. Like, he doesn't even, like, show up to the hospital. It's the clone that shows up to the hospital. Ben shows up to the hospital. And the way you tell him apart is Ben is wearing this ring. Like, he has this ring on his finger, and you could tell it's always him. And these stories talk about that stroke. Mary Jane decides, I don't know what, the stroke caused her in the relationship with Peter decide to revisit her father. Like, she grew up with her aunt. She decides to go visit her father during this traumatic time, and her sister. And her aunt convinces her that she'll take care of May. She's in the hospital in a coma. And so Mary Jane goes off, does that. Peter and Ben get involved in this weird scenario with this asylum that's held, they hold supervillains in. It's called Ravencroft. And Ravencroft is holding Carnage, Shriek, Vermin, a bunch of villains in there. And this guy called the Traveler, who just shows up out of freaking nowhere. He's a psychiatrist who has, it seems like, the ability to possess people or convince them to do certain things. His eyes are red. And I was like, this guy had to have shown up somewhere before. So I, like, Googled him. And this is his first appearance in this clone saga. And I'm like, man, they didn't even introduce this guy. He just shows up, takes over the asylum, kind of makes a bubble around it, and then uses one of his minions to convince Peter and Ben to show up there, and he manipulates them. And he's got this hodgepodge of villains that they introduce that I've never seen before, called Medea. She seems to be like a really strong female. Boone, who's a tracker. Shakara, who is a mystical being. Mr. Knot, who I really don't know. It's like his right-hand man, but I don't know what he could do. And Skrier, which is a villain I've seen before in Spider-Man. So they're working for this Traveler, and it has something to do with the clones. And he like, knows something, and they don't reveal it in these first issues, and it's bizarre. And during these issues, it's a flip book. So the way the Omnibus put it together is they told the story of Ravencroft and Ben fighting Peter in Ravencroft and eventually Traveler taking off with his minions. And then the second part of the flip book is all the backstory of the professor that created the clone. And what is his alias? He wears that mask.
The Jackal?
The Jackal, yeah. I always found that weird. Like, why does he even put on that mask? Like,
he seems like he's a scientist.
What were you saying?
I was saying in his original appearances and stuff. I think it was Miles, like, in the 150s. Yeah, he wore a full green costume.
Yeah, this gives the whole backstory in the flip book. And they chose in the omnibus to break it up. So they tell the Ravencroft story, and then they tell the backstory of the clone. And it's weird because you feel sympathetic towards the clone, because he's the one that cares about MJ. He's the one that cares about losing Gwen. He's the one that cares about Aunt May. And Peter is the one that's acting flippant about it. And the only thing that you could say is, well, whatever happened with his parents, he's devastated. But the way it's written, it's like the clone is the real Peter, and Peter is the clone. It's bizarre. Yeah. At least from an outsider perspective.
Yeah, I want to say... Sorry, Rob.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I want to say I have never read this either, and I also would like to someday get around to it, because it was all when I was out of comics. But I want to say that I've heard that they were intending for Ben to be the real one, and that they wanted Ben to be like the pure, perfect individual, and they partially did that by making Peter act worse and worse so that Ben would look better by comparison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they sort of changed the route that they were going with it, but
yeah, I think there was like I said, I remember there being a lot of backlash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not smooth in this. Like, they're leading it up to you as the reader to figure this stuff out. Like, it's not right in your face. A matter of fact, the writers are making you think Peter's Peter and Ben's Ben.
It's just
the way they're acting. You're like reading it and you're like, what the hell? Like, why?
I'll be
why
interested
isn't it Pete
to know
with Aunt May. You know, like he loves Aunt May more than
to know
life itself.
What you think, and Chris, if you get a chance to read it, what you think, you know, how you enjoy it. I think it's a huge difference to read it now after the fact than to read it when it was originally coming out, because as it's coming out 1 month at a time, you're in the middle of it, right? You're like, where is this going? How is this going to end? You know, some people start getting, like, I wasn't mad about it, but I saw that a lot of people were. Overall, I didn't think at the time that it was done all that well. I think it wasn't one of the best stories.
It's jarring. It's not smooth.
If I were to read it now, I don't think I would dislike it quite as much, because it's all in the past. It's all history. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
where things ended up. You know what I mean? So kind of have more perspective on it.
It's a jarring read, because it's really weird. Like, even this traveler, like, I know there's more coming up on him, but right now I have no clue, other than he's a renowned psychiatrist that has worked with the person in Ravencroft before. But I don't know where all his goons come from, and I don't even know what their objective was. Like, it just seemed like it was manipulating. They do so much switching. Like, it's hard to tell which one's Peter and which one's Ben, and it's like a psychological suspense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they're doing it on purpose to agitate the reader, or to make them second guess what is going on. But you know, it's done by Terry Cavanaugh, J.M. DeMatteis, Howard Mackey, and Tom DeFalco. I was really happy to see Tom DeFalco, because I've become, over the last decade, a huge fan of this guy. Like, never cared about him when he was out publishing a bunch of books, but now everything that he writes is clicking on with me with so many levels. And I'm reading a lot of his epic collections. And it's got Mark Bagley, Tom Lyle, Stephen Butler, and Liam Sharp drawing this first few issues. Really cool stuff. I'm enjoying it. Like, I'm actually enjoying reading the omnibus, too. I have to challenge myself how I'm going to sit and I hold this honking 50-pound book.
That's how I am when I read these. I'm reading the Batman Golden Age books. I, it's like I have to put like a pillow on my lap and then put the book on the pillow.
Yeah, I found some really comfortable, challenging positions that look awful, but they're at least comfortable for me. But this is exciting for me because I know of it. I don't know the details, and it's like I'm experiencing it for the first time. Yeah. So it's interesting. And I know what the ending of it is because I picked up Amazing after it. But this journey seems like it's going to be a really bizarre journey.
Yeah, you can still go on the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll shout out a podcast that's become one of my favorites, Chris and Reggie's Cosmic Treadmill. Mm-hmm. And they do a comic issue every time, and it could be from any time period, but they'll just focus on one issue per episode. But what they do is they'll cover that episode, but they'll also go in depth on the creators, and then they'll also, after they talk about the particular issue, they'll sometimes talk about the context of it and like what happened afterwards and that kind of thing. And they did have an episode where they covered Spectacular Spider-Man number 226, mm-hmm. From the Clone Saga, and so that was I'd recommend that episode as far as like even though they focus on that one issue, like I said, they go into kind of the details about Clone Saga and some of the positives and negatives of it and stuff. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Coverage.
This thing must be like a big, like it lasted forever because there's another, yes, there's going to, I think I have on pre-order another volume of this. And this thing is huge. I mean, it's huge. Yeah.
And that might have been one of the other issues with reading mm-hmm. it at the time, is like, when is this ever going to end? Whereas in retrospect, you know exactly when it's going to end.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's easier with certain stories like that.
I find myself the same way, is where, like, you know, I might have not remembered something that fondly, but then I read it again, either single issues, but you know, one after the other, because they're long completed or as a trade, and I love it a lot more, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just heard somebody the other day saying that on a show, talking about how looking back on Electric Blue Superman, you know, it's different now in hindsight than when they were reading it at the time. Because even though they didn't really believe DC, DC was saying, like, this is Superman now.
Yeah.
This is how Superman, you know, and you know that's not the truth, but.
Well, I'm experiencing that with films right now. Like, I revisited Hellboy and Hellboy 2, and when I saw them at the movie theater, I was like, yeah, they're good. But when I rewatched them, I was like, I'm totally in love with these films now. Like, I'm in love with this stuff. And I want to go back and read Hellboy, which is something I've never desired, because I've dipped my toe in it and I never liked it. But and then I rewatched The Spirit, which I didn't like, and I love reading Spirit comics, at least the stuff I read from Dynamite. I haven't read a lot of Eisner stuff. I've only read maybe 4 or 5 reprints. Mm-hmm. Of the Eisner stuff, but everything I've read from Dynamite and DC when they were doing First Wave, I like love the Spirit character. And when the movie came out, I was like horribly disappointed. And then I rewatched it, and I was like, man, this is freaking awesome, man! Like I love Samuel L. Jackson as the Octopus, and it just there's so many things to Eisner's artistic, like Eisner would artistically do like things where the logo were the buildings and like shadows and light. He would play a lot on that, and Frank Miller did a lot of that in The Spirit. So I revisiting stuff I'm enjoying it.
It can help for sure to make you feel something different.
Yeah, the next one I want to revisit that I saw at the theater and I didn't care for, but now I want to revisit is Dick Tracy. Warren Beatty's and Madonna's Dick Tracy. I want to, even though I bought all the toys, I bought every single Dick Tracy Playmate toy because I was infatuated with the villains, you know, Prune Face and all these guys that just look bizarre.
Yeah.
So I bought all those Playmate toys. They're in the basement.
Yeah, that's funny. I actually want to see that again because I saw it when I was a kid. I liked it, and I didn't get all the toys or anything, but I also was really intrigued by all the villains and by Dick Tracy. And I think I did have some trading cards.
Yeah.
Tie-in for the movie and stuff. But yeah, I really didn't know anything about Dick Tracy, but that movie came out and I saw it and.
Came off the Batman hype is what happened.
Yep. And even though I was pretty much a Marvel kid, I definitely got into the superhero movies, and
yeah.
I definitely got into Batman. And I saw Batman 89 when I was a kid and really liked it. But so I'll kind of going off of that. It's like, oh, here's another superhero movie, or at least comic related movie, even though it wasn't a comic character I knew of. But yeah, all the different villains and stuff they were cool. Yeah.
So maybe and I'm 20 years from now, I'll enjoy Tom King's Batman.
you'll probably be raving about it.
Yeah, I'll be like, wow, man, what was I thinking back then?
Yeah, you never know.
Well, 20 years from now, I'll be almost 70, so. God damn.
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah.
Like time seems to be passing way too quickly.
Yeah.
I know. Well, I have one more that I read that I'll just cover real quickly.
Sure.
But you guys are not going to expect what comic I'm going to talk about.
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Well, you're not going to expect what comic I talk about because it is...
It's the unexpected!
The unexpected. and it's specifically issue 173, a 30-cent comic. And on the cover, there's a sinking ship in the background. A guy is carrying a blonde woman out of the water. And he's saying, "A dog, we're safe, honey. There must be life on this island." And, you know, so yeah, there's a dog and, but in the foreground of the image are a bunch of human skeletons. So this has a couple stories in it. The first one is called What Scared Sally. And, it's interesting. The artist is properly credited. All the writers in these stories are all pseudonyms. And what I'm talking about, I'll look it up again, because I know one of them is the editor, Murray Baltanoff. And, you know, he definitely wrote a handful of stuff. He's more known as an editor for DC. But he did write some stuff. It tended to be stuff for the horror anthologies and that kind of stuff. The artist, though, is Fred Carrillo, which I hadn't heard of, but that is his real name. It looks like he tended to work on these sort of horror anthologies and also some, you know, House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Ghosts, Witching Hour, but also some war stuff. And it's credited as Bill Dennehy, but it was Murray Boltonoff that wrote this first story called What Scared Sally. And it's a 7-page story. And it's about this family who the father takes a job as the caretaker of a cemetery. So they have to live in the cottage on the cemetery grounds. And it was the only job he could find, but his wife is concerned about who's gonna court their daughter, or and who's gonna play with their younger son when they live in a cemetery. Meanwhile, the brother and the sister, you know, they're out exploring, and they come across this tunnel, and it looks like it was like a mining tunnel. You know, it has the structures, like the framing with wood to keep up the tunnel and stuff. And they come across a skeleton, and his sister gets scared, so they leave and they come out a different entrance, and they run into these two guys that look pretty suspicious, but they tell them that they're government agents, and so they buy it basically, but it's pretty clear that they're not, and they say, you know, you got a hiding space? You know, we're on a secret message, or we're on a secret mission, so nobody's supposed to know we're here. They got a hiding place, and so that the boy takes them back to the tunnels that they found. They feed them food and, you know, bring it from their refrigerator and stuff for them. And the one guy talks like he wants to hit on the daughter, and the other guy's like beats him up a little bit about it because he doesn't want to get in trouble and go back into jail. Says something about solitary, and it's like, so they argue with each other about who's putting them more in danger and stuff. And so eventually they realize that the kids are onto them, and they call them back, and they pull out one of these support structures, and it allows the tunnel to cave in on top of the kids. So eventually the parents realize that they're missing. They go looking for them. They find the dirt pile they're buried in, and they call for help, and a bunch of other men come, and they're able to get them out. They're unconscious, but they're still breathing, so they rush them to the hospital. And so earlier they talked about how there was a separate entrance from this. Excuse me a second. Mm-hmm. There's a separate entrance from these tunnels that the guys can get out. So when the convicts caused the tunnel to cave in, they figured we can get out the other side. Well, when they're taking the kids out and taking them to the hospital, the men are talking about things and how they locked up this other entrance to the tunnels and stuff. So basically, like, implication being that they those men are actually trapped down there. then there's just a short, let me see, I think the next story, I thought this was the short one. I know there's one that's, yeah. It's just two. There's two stories that are 5 pages each. The next one, it's not credited, but the artist is the same, Fred Carrillo. It's called I, the Imprisoned Brain. And basically, it's about a disembodied brain that's being kept alive on equipment and actually has ears and eyes attached to it. And it's in this kind of vat. And it's conscious, but it has no way of communicating with the scientists that are working on it. But it turns out that one of the scientists that are working on it is actually the guy that murdered the person who the brain belonged to. And so he's trying to find a way to permanently kill the brain, because the other scientist is working on a way to try to communicate with it. So he sneaks in the lab later on at night and tries to attack it, but he runs into a watchman, and so he's not able to get the chance at that night. And there's a trial as to whether this scientist killed him or not, and he's got to defend himself. And you know, that's one of the reasons he wanted to get rid of the witness. Well. when the prosecution comes up to call their first witness, they say, yeah, we're ready to call our first witness, the victim himself. And this guard that got this guard that was killed by the scientist as well, the one that came upon him trying to kill the brain, he walks in with the victim's brain attached to his head. And he's they transferred his brain onto the guard's head. He looks like Simon from DC or something like that. It's pretty crazy. And that's like the surprise ending. And then the last story is credited to someone named Jack Phillips, but it's actually written by George Cashton, who wrote a lot of these kind of things. And then the art is by Tenney Henson, who also is an artist that looks like most of his work was from these kind of horror and
anthologies. How did you find out it was a different person?
Oh, yeah, thanks. I should credit. It's Mike's Amazing World of Comics that has the correct information. So Hunger of the Dying is the last story, and this one is the one that kind of relates to the cover. Even though there's never actually like a young couple like you see on the cover.
I love this cover. I think it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, in terms of like a horror or something like that, you know, they see a dog. Oh, we found civilization. And there's all these corpses just lying there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat. There is a shipwreck at sea. One man manages to survive by holding on to wreckage, and he passes out but wakes up on an island where there's tons of skeletons, like on the cover. And he passes out again on the beach, and another man wakes him up. This first guy's name's Croker, and the man that wakes him up is called Fane. And it turns out that Fane also survived the shipwreck and their mascot, this dog, Leaf. Leaf helped Fane get to shore by letting him hold on. And so Fane's already been around the island. He hasn't been able to find any food, and the only thing that they have to eat is stuff that's washed ashore that was on their ship. So Croker, the first guy we saw, he's having some thoughts. He's scheming, realizing that they're not going to be able to survive very long. And if he was the only one alive, he would be, he'd have a better chance. So he's scheming to kill Fane while Fane's sleeping next to the dog. But the dog wakes up and barks at him, and that wakes up Fane, and he realizes that Croker's trying to kill him. Croker's pissed because Fane is keeping the dog alive too, and he's mad that the dog is getting rations. Croker still manages to kill Fane, and the dog is really upset. And then later that night, he sees the dog eating food, and he advances on the dog with the knife, and so the dog fights him. And the dog actually manages to grab the knife out of his hand and goes running off with it and hides it. A lot of time passes, and you could tell like the dog gets skinnier and Croker is not doing very well, and they just kind of have like a standoff between them. Croker thinks that the dog is going to eat him, so he's afraid to go to sleep. And the dog just sits and like guards the place that that he buried Fane. And so it gets to the point that they're down to the last of the food, and when Croker hears a ship going by, and so he tries to set a fire to alert the passing ship, and the dog starts kicking dirt over the fire to put it out. He's like, "Why is he doing that?" And he's like, "Oh, I forgot all about it." He had built the fire right on top of Fane's grave, so the dog was protecting the grave and putting out the fire. And so it ends with the dog barking at Croker, and he's not looking too good. The last caption says, "In a moment, the dog would claim unexpected vengeance for its murdered master and never go hungry again." So
I don't know about that. That's going to be not an unlimited supply of meat.
No. I guess, but they don't want you to think about that. They had the dog win, and they want to just leave it at that.
Which, that's okay with me.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, as long as the dog.
Happy ending.
Yeah. The dog eats the human. All right.
Yeah.
Hooray! Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's fun. These horror anthologies that they had back in the day were a lot of fun. Like, I came across an house ad for DC, and it was just like, it said something like something for every mood or so. I think it was in Challengers, and it had a picture of, here it is, for every mood. It has a picture of an issue of Sugar and Spike, an issue of Superboy, an issue of Star Spangled War Stories, and an issue of From Beyond the Unknown. And
so I think when New 52 came out, they tried to do that. They tried to give us war. They tried to give us horror, you know, like I, Vampire. And they tried to give us a little bit of a diversity. And they realized, man, this stuff just doesn't sell anymore. Everybody wants the superheroes and the popular ones. So when Rebirth came, that's what they focused on. And that's why I think Rebirth is more successful in terms of dollars, because their focus is not on the diversity of their lineup, it's on their highlights of the characters that people want to read.
Yeah, and I think it's very smart from a publishing standpoint. Like, that's what I would do too.
Yeah.
If, you know, I just wanted to do my job well and succeed, you know, but so it's not their fault, but it's all just what sells, and they would do it if it would sell. But it's too bad, because it just seems really cool.
The gems are hitting in the Dial H's and the stuff where they could get away with murder.
Yeah. So yeah, when you look back to the 70s at their lineup, it's just fun to see all the different genres and stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I like Amigo Comics, because they do really good horror. Tales of the Suicide Forest, man, that's really good.
Yeah, at least there's a way for those smaller companies to publish stuff and get it to their customers, because they kind of fill in that gap, because they don't have to get to the same numbers. Because, one other thing I was going to say when I was talking about Challengers is that it's one of those issues that has the statement of ownership and circulation in it.
Yeah.
I love that.
And for Challengers of the Unknown, it says the average number of copies of each issue during the preceding 12 months was 140,584.
God dang. And that's a comic that, like, nobody knows who they are except for fans. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it was selling like 140,000 copies an issue. Sweet.
I never had a Challengers comic except when they appeared with other books. Until I read Jeff Loeb's Challengers of the Unknown, when he did it with the guy who did Long Halloween, Tim Sale. Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, when they did Challengers of the Unknown. And then I went back and bought a lot of them.
Nice. Yeah, I just got the first showcase volume of Challengers, but other than that, I mean, like, and I'm hoping to get into that fairly soon, but I haven't read much by them or about them.
I have the Kirby collection of that, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh yeah, and I read that short when they were in DC, the new DC Comics Presents in New 52. Mm-hmm. I remember I read
that. That was good. That was Dan DiDio. I like that. That was
yeah,
really
it was
good.
Cool. It was cool.
That was a good story. It got me pumped, and then when it ended, I was like, wow, that's going to be it for a long time. I was like, I'm not going to see these characters. That was a good 3-issue arc. I miss the idea of that because I like anthologies that explore the characters that can't hold their own title. It just nobody buys it. I mean, I buy it, but I'm the minority, so.
Yep. Yeah, you can fit that right in with the stuff we said about the other genres, you know.
Yeah.
That they tried with the New 52. They even had that National Comics that there was a few issues of, where they had like Looker and a couple other weird characters.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That was cool because it had some of the Freedom Fighter stuff in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They even took chances. They did a Human Bomb and they did a The Ray.
The miniseries, yeah.
Yep, Phantom Lady.
Yeah, so I'm like in freaking heaven when they do that. Yeah, it's Phantom Lady and Doll Man. Mm-hmm. God dang, those are good old days. Got anything else, Rob?
I do not.
I have one other thing I'm going to mention. I'm continuing my journey on Jack Kirby's The Losers. And I read, let's see, 154 of Our Fighting Forces. These stories are very different, man, than like anything I've ever read, because these characters, it's different than any other Kirby thing I've read. Like, I almost feel like he's going through motions with this one in terms of creativity. But they're bizarre, because this adventure, when you think about it at the high level, it's pretty ingenious, but when you think about how it turned into screw up, it's almost like he tries to make them losers, like do some stupid stuff. But they're on these weird missions, and they're an oddball group of characters, and they have to get this Yoshimoto guy, who's a Japanese from the Pacific Islands. They had to capture him, but it makes you wonder if they were really trying to capture him or get him away from something, because the way it ends. So they capture him, and immediately he escapes. So it's the losers and this French guy. And then when he escapes, he has all the Japanese soldiers go after the losers. And it looks like they're going to end up getting killed, because what is that thing where they actually fight Bushido? I can't remember what it's called. It's a Japanese term.
Bushido?
Bushido, yeah. It's like a code. And then Cloud actually goes to fight him just with hand-to-hand combat. And what Cloud reveals is, yeah, we were supposed to get you away from this fort so we could bomb the heck out of it. So it was like a military hub where they had all the guns and all that stuff. And what happened is they got him away so he could fight Cloud. And then they blew the heck out of it. The rest of the Marines and the Americans blew the crap out of it and killed all of them. While the losers, their whole job was just to get them away from it. It was really bizarre. The other thing that's interesting is Jack Kirby, at the end of each issue, he draws things like the weapons and stuff. And these are like historically legit. But one of the things that they had is a Rolls-Royce armored car that was used in World War I, and they also used it in World War II. It was called the Britisher. It looks really bizarre. But he actually drew all these weapons and stuff, which is really fascinating. They had an 18T Prime Mover, a ZGKW, which was a German vehicle that had, like, it looked like a sort of vanish transport with a trend like a tank. And they said they designed it like in Africa to go over the terrain, and it would work really well, but it required heavy maintenance. So like he gives you a lot of factual stuff that's really cool. It's almost like reading G.I. Joe when you read Larry Hama, you know, how he'd explain some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm enjoying this journey because it's so weird. Like I have no idea what to expect in each adventure. And that's it.
Very cool.
I'm gonna read some more Clone Saga.
Where?
And Iron Man, because that's what I'm on right now.
Yeah, you guys are good on the themes. You had the episode I wasn't on that you both covered Guardians related stuff.
We didn't plan that though.
No, I know. And then you're both talking about Spider-Man this time, and
you fit into the. I saw Homecoming. I will say that I really do enjoy Michael Keaton. I love that guy. Like when he gets his crazy eyes going, like you see Beetlejuice, Batman, you see Pacific Heights, you see this movie. He's really like threat. I really like it.
What was the movie where he and a bunch of other guys were all mental patients?
No.
I'm looking it up.
I love that movie.
The Dream Team.
Oh, yes!
Yeah.
With Christopher Lloyd, Peter Boyle, Stephen Furst. Yeah, I saw that when I was younger. And that was really good. Gosh. He's really good in that.
I'm a fan of Michael Keaton. I just like him.
I love that. Mr. Mom, you've seen Gung Ho.
Actually, the Dream Team came out like only like 2 months before Batman.
Wow.
Yeah.
It came out on my birthday, actually. April 7th, 1989.
I love when he gets crazy eyes, though. He looks like he's going to bust somebody up. And he does it in all those movies, like when he goes psychotic.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hoping to maybe see it next weekend.
Yeah, me too.
Like even in Batman 89, when he's just talking to the Joker when they're at Kim Basinger's apartment, and he just goes, "You want to go crazy? I'll go crazy." And he just grabs that thing from the fireplace, and he's gonna.
Yeah, that's a good scene.
Yeah, he just. I like when he goes nuts. I'm a fan. And have you guys seen Pacific Heights?
I
would recommend that if you like Michael Keaton.
I'm looking at it. I don't think I have. That was actually the movie that followed Batman.
You ought to see it because he's a psycho in this one. He's a manipulative psycho. Yeah. He's like the tenant.
Yeah, it looks pretty.
He's like the tenant that you don't ever want to come into your rental. Like ever, like the nightmare.
Yeah, it looks pretty creepy on the movie poster.
Yep.
Yeah. It's good. I gotta watch it again. I gotta find it. Sometimes it's fun seeing if you could find this streaming or on direct TV or something. All right, well, that has been this episode of Retrocast, and you can reach us on the Twitters, at MythMakingETC is Chris, at Rob Krieger on the Twitter, and I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. We're on the Geek Brunch podcast feed, and you can find MythMakingETC also on the web. What's that website?
MythMakingETC.blogspot.com.
And you are blogging there too. You're doing like what I do, except at a much higher effort.
Well, I'm just doing it in written format.
Yeah, I do it in written format, but I just do it in Notepad, and I don't put covers, and I don't let anybody see it, and then I record about it in Mike M's. That's my thing. Slightly different. The thing I like about it, though, Chris, for me personally, is it helps me remember things a lot more, too. Because
me too.
You sit down, like, even if it's for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you sit down and you absorb what you just consumed. And it helped. It, right. It's like repeating in your brain. So when you repeat something in your brain, it helps you just remember it more. So it gives you that.
It's like when you're in school and they're like, write a 2-sentence summary of what you just read. Like, it's like reading. It helps you with your comprehension.
Yes, it does.
But scroll down, go to the comic forums, scroll down to the Geek Brunch.
Yes, at the comic forums. We're on Facebook at Forum for Geeks. No.
DC-noise.blogspot.com.
I invested a lot into that Geek Comic Geek Speak forum, and I lost all of it when they stopped paying the bill. I had a lot of information in there.
Yeah, I've heard you on DC Noise, on old DC Noise, talk about how you were posting reviews of Warlord and like
I put a lot of and stuff,
different runs and stuff like that, and like it makes me wish I could go and look at it, but
it's all gone. And the thing that I miss most is I used to track movies, every movie I ever watched and what I ranked. And then when I lost it all, I lost all. I just said, screw it. I should have done what I did with just on my local machine where I know I can control my own backups.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, it's been a pleasure.
Yes. Yes, and, absolutely.
Every book that Chris picked, believe it or not, I don't own.
Yeah. That's 3 for 3, baby.
3 for 3 this time. Everyone Rob picked, I do own, and I have read.
He doesn't have my ability. Nope. If only I could figure out how to monetize this gift. Well,
if you stay in the realm of horror, like DC horror, that's my weak spot.
Uh huh.
Yeah, that's my that's where I don't have a lot. When you get into romance too, I have a lot, but I don't have everything. But you get into like the main superheroes, it's gonna be tough.
Yeah.
If you get into the Superman, Batman, anything post 73, I pretty much have Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
But a lot of I'm missing a lot of Marvels, just like we talked about Clone Saga. I don't own that.
Yeah.
So this is something I've always wanted to read. And it's weird because rabbit hole, like just the fact that I saw Spider-Man got me in a rabbit hole, you know? So I'm leaving the Iron Man, even though Iron Man is in Spider-Man. I'm still going to complete the Iron Man just because I'm almost caught up. Like I'm almost completely caught up with Iron Man.
Yeah, you got to finish that off.
And it all started off with International. Like, I fell in love with that story. I fell totally in love with it.
I thought International was really, really good.
Even though it's a retcon, it was so good. It was so, like, his parents are not his parents. I mean, I just, like, blew my mind.
Yep.
It's so good. I'd recommend it, like, to anybody that wants to get a good Tony Stark story. Like if you want action, don't read it. But if you want a good Tony Stark story, it'll hook you, man. Bendis is good at that, but you have to read it all in one sitting, I think.
Yeah, it was very good.
Yeah,
I'm enjoying the Infamous Iron Man more than
I'm almost there. I'm almost there. I got 3 more issues of Invincible on Bendis, and then I jump into his 2 new ones, which is
it's Dr. very Doom interesting to see Doctor Doom.
Yeah. Doctor Doom and Riri.
Yeah.
She's even... I just read her introduction. She's interesting. Like, she's very strange. Strange girl.
For whatever reason, the new Invincible is not really... it's not clicking with me, but I really like it.
So. Well, I like her when he's writing. She's not the main character. I don't know what...
Yeah, I do too.
I don't know what I'll feel about it when she is. We'll see.
Yeah.
Makes me want to complete my Iron Man run, for sure. Because I'm close, man. I'm close. I got all the expensive stuff, except for I don't think I'll ever get Tales of Suspense, the first Iron Man.
You never know. You just got the first Daredevil.
Yeah, you never know. That's true. I never thought I'd have the first Daredevil either. So, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right, well, guys, have a great Sunday and a good week at work.
Yeah, you too.
All right, you too.
Take it easy. Bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.